In the Dark Ages, the worship of natural substances was quite common.
The soil, water, sands of the desert, various plants.
But the strongest cults were those that worshipped the most mystical substance of all, the fountainhead of life itself. The glorification of blood.
Thank you.
But more often than not,
human blood. Now, what your man Hansen witnessed was a very ancient ritual ceremony. It has all the elements. The slaughter of the cockerel, the inherent vileness of evil triumphant, the obscenities, the marking of the supplicants, the human sacrifice. Now, that, of course, could be faked, but it's the symbolism that counts.
So it's Friday, it's a minute past 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday the 24th of March 2023, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol, on the talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. Available free. Gosh, not much for free these days. Actually, there are a few ads on it, but it's a terrific app, I would say that. From all good app stores, anything but Google, please, including the Apple Store. I'm Tony Gosling. Thanks for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its psychological warfare propaganda of all different sorts, and navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, or the World Economic Forum's privatisation of the world. It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Well, the planets are aligning over Bristol this week. 20 years since the Armageddonist Iraq war. 3 years since Boris Johnson announced the SARS-CoV-2, then known lockdown. And 2 years since the Kill the Bill protests here in Bristol, which were flashed around the world with pictures of burning police cars. We're joined in the studio by jailed Kill the Bill protester Jasmine York, and also by a friend of the show, co-founder of the UK 9/11 Truth Campaign way back in the noughties, and author of 9/11 The New Evidence, Ian Henshaw. So, first of all, I think probably the best thing to do is go straight to you, Jasmine, actually. Thanks ever so much for coming in. And can you just take us through the events? What was it that made you actually go along to this demonstration 2 years ago? Why did you think it was something important to do?
Hello, Jasmine York. Initially I was aware of a demonstration, sort of vigil happening for Sarah Everard. And that was generally my motivation to go down to College Green.
So remember, this is lockdown time, and mm-hmm. there's not supposed to be any demonstrations at all.
But it wasn't illegal. So as far as I was concerned, I was well within my right to go and attend, so long as I was socially distancing. I didn't think it was too much of an issue.
Well, no, I don't think it was. And I think it was appalling to see the police steam into the Sarah Everard vigil, which, amazingly, Kate Middleton even came along to, you know, the up at Clapham. So this whole idea of stopping protests during the lockdown itself was contentious, wasn't it?
Yes. And the fact is, I mean, after the demonstrations happened, the police argued that they were allowed to use excessive force because it was COVID that they'd said that the protests were illegal, and obviously they took that back and realised it wasn't even in the legislation, so a lot of their behaviour that day, they were unlawful.
Yeah, and Martin might want to chip in here, mightn't you, Martin? So you went along to the Black Lives Matter demo too.
Yeah, that's right, and I think lots of people wearing masks. We tried to be as socially distanced as we possibly could, and I think political protests, because something like the death of George Floyd only happens once, and if you don't demonstrate immediately, then you lose the momentum. And I think the Bristol police on that occasion, I thought, were excellent in the way they policed it.
But
they allowed everything to happen, and they videoed it, so that if anybody wanted to complain about it, they could be dealt with later.
I mean, you could argue, couldn't you, Jasmine, that there's a good protest and a bad protest, because there's such a difference with the way Kill the Bill was policed.
That's often determined by how the police are going to decide to manage it. So I think, actually, the way that they policed the BLM protests in Bristol was then to a detriment to the Kill the Bill demonstrators, because there was such a pressure on Avon and Somerset to police more heavily, and so therefore they used more force.
Well, Andy Heyman, who was in charge on the day of the BLM protest, he was sacked by Priti Patel for doing his job properly. And that's the pressure that the police are
under. A lot
of
this story is coming from Priti Patel. It's coming from the Home Office. And I suppose the Avon and Somerset police think, we better do what we're told.
I mean, I would definitely agree. I mean, if you look at the riot charges and how far you have to go up the CPS to even be granted the chance to charge people with riot, it goes quite high up. I think there was a lot of pressure coming from all different angles, to be honest with you.
Okay, so it's March, if we could take us back a couple of years to March 2021. Can you just take us through what happened? Because, I mean, certainly the way I've seen it is that there was quite a rowdy demonstration, but the police then decided that they had to be moved from outside the cop shop.
So essentially we, quite commonly in... on protests, you do a march around Bristol and you come down Union Street and then past Bridewell. It's quite common. I don't think it's unusual. But we stopped outside of Bridewell. But by the time we'd got there, the police had already set up a line of riot in riot gear. So they were already there in riot gear. And there's a lot of debate about whether it was a riot, whether it was a protest or not. But it was around 3 p.m, I think. And already by Bridewell, they were in their riot gear. So even that in itself was threatening, just to come around the corner doing a normal trail walk and for them to be in riot gear. And then we were essentially kettled in because there were coppers by the pub and then so that past Bridewell, so we couldn't walk through.
Now, hang on, because the definition of a kettle is just pretty serious. It means you can't get out.
You couldn't get out, no. As far as that, you could not get out.
Wow.
For ages. There were times where it was like a horseshoe scenario.
So you've got several hundred people there. Any idea roughly how many?
It's
difficult to say.
Debate,
I mean, it was about, there were about 250 this week. But the thing is that the people that are there for a specific purpose. That's to challenge the idea of the limitation of the right to protest.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I mean, there's all sorts of things involved in this new law. But another major thing is the confiscation of the homes of gypsies and travellers. I mean, this is actually an incredibly political piece of legislation they're trying to push through during a lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
And you could even argue maybe they're using the lockdown as the time to do it, to try and limit the protest against it.
I think that's why tensions were so high and that's why there was so much engagement, because people were becoming more aware of politics because of how badly the Tory government was handling lockdown anyway. And so a lot of how they handled anything during that time was sort of scrutinised. So actually, I think it drew quite a lot of attention. I think they tried to maybe pass it quite quickly without much notice. But to be honest, I think it did the opposite.
So your case has been in the press. I'm not sure about nationally, but certainly locally, people have been following it. I've seen the pictures of the really nasty bruises and the bites you've got on the back of your right shoulder, I think.
I got a bit on the thigh.
Oh, was it? Yeah. Oh, okay, I thought it was your shoulder, sorry.
I got battered quite badly along my left side of my body, yeah.
Okay, so do you want to just explain how that happened?
So that happened, the beatings happened relatively early in the day. So when we walked towards Bridewell, I honestly believe if the police hadn't done a front riot line, then we would have carried on walking. But by then point, when we kind of were just standing still, and again, what's up for debate is who hit first, who threw the first punch, la-di-da, and that could go on for ages. But essentially, it just got more rowdy. And most of my footage, which was shown during my trial, was just me trying to keep distance between the line of protesters and then the line of police. I'm not one for conversing with police, and at that point, also, it wouldn't have been effective anyway. But I would get hit by police officers just for towing the line. And there's quite a famous quote in my trial when a police officer was forced to watch the footage of him beating me up. My barrister said, "Well, why did you do that?" And he said, "She got in my space." And it literally is just me walking along the line, literally probably a metre from protesters and a metre from police.
Well, the other thing is there were actually quite a lot of journalists either arrested or beaten at the same demonstration, weren't there?
Yeah, horrendous. I saw one journalist get thrown to the ground. It was horrendous.
Which is why it's particularly surprising to see this leaked memo from the Bristol branch of the National Union of Journalists, which I used to be secretary of and vice chair of. I mean, I just shuddered to read it because it seemed to be so one-sided. It's saying to all the journalists in the city, this is going to be very dangerous, and really painting the demonstrators as the danger, not the police. Now, how do you react to that?
I'm on the fence because obviously a lot of the coverage of the protests 2 years ago were talking about the injuries that the police had sustained and then very quietly retracted that.
Mm.
And so I think that email was perpetuating those lies. And again, as an activist,
it was before the demo this week, wasn't it?
Yes, it was before. It was a couple of days before that it was sent, and I saw it a couple of days before the demo myself, and was quite concerned because there was mention of the NUJ talking to police and saying it's going to be an antagonistic event. Yeah. And I was like, I don't know where from anywhere you've got that from. Why?
Well, this is the this is not National NUJ. This is the, I imagine, the executive of the Bristol branch of the National Union of Journalists. And I was bullied out of there back in around about 2011, 2009. I'd never want to have really anything to do with them again, because I just found my experience was, I mean, they were just smearing me as a David Icke supporter, all sorts of other smears, and I just found the whole process of trying to defend myself against a bunch of trumped up charges really ridiculous and not the sort of thing that journalists should be doing to other journalists. Okay, so can we have a, what I'm going to do now is because you were a speaker on Tuesday evening, and I actually have to say I really love these demonstrations. There's so much passion in them. There was no real violence at all this week, and you know, you do wonder whether there is a bit of a history of demonstrations which are rowdy but actually largely peaceful, Martin, with the police deciding they're going to turn them into a riot.
Yeah, well, I mean, last week when we had Mariella's mother Heidi on the show, I did mention what had happened at the so-called Tesco riot in 2011, because there was as you know, it was a big campaign in the local community here in Stokescroft to keep Tesco out. There was a peaceful picket line outside Tesco's, which was working, because people in this community didn't want it. And so people turned up and said, we're having a picket line to get them out. People say, they were walking on down the road. So it was very successful. But what happened is that in the afternoon, supposedly in Telepathic Heights, the squat that was up the road here, a couple of young lads were making petrol bombs. That's what the police said. Afterwards, I don't believe that, to be honest with you. I don't think they were making petrol bombs. But what happened is, in the evening at about 9 p.m, a huge load of armed riot police turned up from outside the city. So they'd come in from Devon and Cornwall. They're from Bristol.
Hang on, when you say armed, you mean guns? No.
I mean, there was somebody with a gun. Somebody did have a gun. Some of them were armed with guns. Because if you remember, the guy who eventually elected as the local councillor for the area said, well, what are you doing with the heckling cots of machine guns? I said, well, what's that for? This is Britain. He said, the police said, this is Britain in 2011, you know. And they turned up completely mob-handed with loads of people from outside the city, and the Welsh police in particular, they've been really fired up by whoever had spoken to them. We're going to St. Paul's, you know, with all of that. And loads of people drinking in the street, because it was a bank holiday weekend because of a royal wedding. So it was a sunny evening. Loads of people were sitting outside the pubs drinking. And suddenly at 9 o'clock, hundreds of riot police turned up. There'd been no incident of any kind. Nothing to, you know, this was all planned in advance. I mean, we found out from Freedom of Information Racks information, and we spoke to the fire brigade, and the fire brigade said they warned us something was going to happen. And of course, the pickets were told by a local police officer, we don't know what's going on, but something's happening here, heads up. So the local beat police hadn't been told what was going to happen.
There's a lot of parallels between this and the Kill the Bill.
That's why I'm mentioning it.
100%, because especially when they contacted other constabularies, like they were, so you could hear the other officers saying, we don't know what we're doing. We don't even know what the plan is. We don't know what we're doing. And the police officers genuinely looked terrified, but also terrifying at the same time.
Well, I know for a fact, because I went and talked to the Bristol police after this incident, because if you said there's a meeting, Tony, and I went in and talked to them about it. And I said exactly the same things I'm saying now to the Bristol police. And
so this is the other line than the official NUJ line into the police.
Yeah, well, I went in and had a chat with them, you know, and I was, and of course, what in actual fact, Kerry McCarthy, who's the MP for Bristol East, she found out, heard what was going on, and she lives down in the harbour, so she came with her right hand man Ben to see what was happening. Anyway, they just arrived, and what was actually happening is the police, they were hitting people, breaking things, allowing dogs to bite people, mm-hmm. but nobody was fighting back.
Yeah, but there was a lot of compensation in the courts after all this, wasn't there?
Well, anyway, so but at the same time, the community was just saying, go home, you know, get out of here. They weren't throwing anything, and Kerry came down to watch him, and a Welsh riot policeman came over and whacked Ben over the head with a riot bat on, and he said, ow, that really hurt. I'm a full-time worker for the Labour Party, and this is my MP standing here, and this Welsh policeman, like, but you could, I think what was behind all of this was an attempt. Bristol has a reputation for being a place of protest, successful protest, like the peaceful protests against Tesco. It's a bit like Bologna used to be in Italy in the 1970s. Yeah. So what they want to do is they want to turn it into a violent protest, because that's part of the strategy, that the strategy of tension, they used to call it in Italy. Yeah. So that's why they brought all these. And of course, subsequently in the August, eventually at 3 a.m, they all went home. You know, they just packed up and got in the vans and went. Yeah. And that was the end of that.
All right, Martin. It's just here now. Jasmine speaking earlier this week on Tuesday evening outside Bridewell, the 2-year anniversary, which was probably would never have happened if it hadn't been for the appalling sentences that many of the people involved in that demonstration and the terrible treatment by the police.
Us protesters aren't a threat to society. That's a direct quote from Judge Patrick. We are a threat to the state. They lock us away in the hope that we leave prison either demoralised or in a body bag. I believe, perhaps for my own sanity, that my incarceration symbolises how powerful we are as a unit and why it's imperative we continue to be proactive in the face of state oppression. Okay, now I want to address Eamon in Somerset. Eamon in Somerset, hello! Okay, obviously come in early. Amateurs. You have at least 26 officers still serving despite misconduct, including sexual harassment and racial discrimination. Do you have anything to say for yourselves? That's embarrassing, isn't it? Yeah, scrub! Uniform isn't sexy, you know. It's out of fashion. Okay, anyway. Now, I know the slogan, defund the police, perplexes all of you. A lot of the bootlickers, so let me suggest something. Defund the 26 are still working here and are exploiting our comrades every damn day. 26 of you, defund them!
So that's Jasmine speaking on Tuesday evening, making, I thought, a really important point, which is actually there's this whole controversy around the police right now, where we've had two Met officers who have been committing incredibly serious crimes, including murder and multiple scores of rapes, and yet they've been allowed to continue to serve. And also in Avon and Somerset, we've got a whole bunch of a backlog of disciplinary hearings.
Yeah, and what's devastating and scary is that even when you have a misconduct hearing within Avon and Somerset, it's not grounds for dismissal, and that those misconduct allegations are sexual assault and racial discrimination.
Well, that's kind of fair, isn't it? Because it's an allegation. Until that allegation is tested, they shouldn't be sacked.
But 17 were upheld.
It should be an option to sack somebody if it's a very serious misconduct.
Yeah. So even if you're found guilty of misconduct, which I think 17 of the 26 so far have been,
right,
they still can't be dismissed. They can still operate.
I think it is the difference is between misconduct and serious misconduct. I think we had our chief constable sacked a few years ago. Actually, he seemed to be quite a decent bloke, and so maybe that's why they sacked him. But that was Nick Gargan, I think, a few years ago. But these procedures, I think, you know, this is one of the things that I've teased out over the years, speaking to ex-cops that have been sacked, good cops, etc., is that there is this thing called professional standards within the police who are law unto themselves. Nobody keeps a check on them. And often, if people do go to the professional standards within Avon and Somerset, and obviously within the Met, what happens is that they are then targeted. They can sometimes then themselves be sacked. They can then get accused of all sorts of things that they haven't done in order to discourage police that know that they've got criminal colleagues from ever going to the professional standards and doing anything about it. Martin, basically the system's broken, isn't it? This is something that really needs to be shaken up. At least we've had a couple of convictions over the last few months with this new head of the Met, but it's still the same system is in place.
It is, and I think we do have to distinguish between different police forces. You know, the Met are a really definitely to be regarded as one of the worst, and I lived in London for 16 years. Of course, in Northern Ireland, the Royal Ulster Constabulary was completely disbanded and reformed as the police service of Northern Ireland. And in fact, that has actually worked because they have transformed the way they operate, and the community has got a very different attitude to what they call the NIPS, That's what the Republicans call the NIPS, the Northern Ireland Police Service, rather than the Peelers, as they used to call the RUC. And, of course, they've got a lot more Catholic nationalist officers. Many of them, who might in the past have joined the IRA, are now police officers. So that's actually improved things. But, it's always, you're only as good as your last game with any of this stuff. You know, it only takes one thing to go wrong and everything can be, the atmosphere can be poisoned for a generation.
Okay, Jasmine, can you talk about your case? And, you did time, didn't you?
Yes, so I was sentenced for 9 months and then I did 10 weeks inside at Eastwood Park.
Oh, that's actually not... I mean, how come you didn't do the full sentence? How does that work?
So when you get sentenced to prison, generally you do half and then of that inside, but then you can be eligible for early release, which is when you're released on tag. And when I was offered that, I originally said no, because part of my licence conditions, they added that I cannot be political, indirectly or directly, and it was a very vague condition, and I couldn't talk about my prison experience. This time last year, I wouldn't be able to. Well, I was in prison this time last year, but when I got out, I wouldn't have been able to do interviews like this. I wouldn't be able to talk about it, which I thought was interesting, and that's why.
Isn't that interesting? My God, why could you not talk about it?
Couldn't go to meetings. Couldn't post things on social
media.
They're
quite good at stopping journalists getting into jail.
What were you charged with in the end?
Arson. My convictions had all my license conditions had nothing to do with arson, so I could light as many fires as I wanted. But do you know what I mean? There was just no. It was all relevant to the political context of why I was put in the first place.
It's just like having a gagging order on you.
That's exactly how I described it.
Yeah. So how did you get that overturned?
They allowed, so long as I was upfront about where I was going, then it would be fine. But then obviously I was apprehensive to say to my probation officer, oh, by the way, I'm going to an activist meeting to organise that. La, la, la.
Yeah, because you're kind of dobbing them in, aren't you?
Oh, exactly.
You're encouraging an undercover cop to come along as well, maybe.
So you just got to work around it.
Okay, what about your time inside then? What was it like in which, so where did you say you were again?
Eastwood Park.
Okay, and that's not far from Bristol, is it?
No, Gloucestershire. So
Gloucestershire.
About 40 minutes down
and
the road.
And so how was your time in there? What was the
horrendous.
Conditions like?
Horrendous, absolutely horrendous. I mean, there's two reports that have come out in the last 6 months saying about it's probably the worst prison conditions in all of the women's prisons in the UK. Absolutely vile. Just the self-harm and suicide rates are off the chain. And in the last 10 months, they've had 4 inmates die in that one prison alone. Horrendous. Absolutely
horrendous. When you say horrendous, what did you see inside that was so... I mean, was it just that you know, because sometimes places have got just a kind of thuggish bullying culture where it's almost like the people that are running it don't really care. Was there anything specific?
So the response to... inmates trying to kill themselves or self-harm was horrendous, and how just the neglect to that. So I think my second day there was a woman who had tried to end her life by consuming duvet threads.
Eating them.
I think she thought she could eat enough duvet threads that somehow her body would pack in.
Right, the idea is that a duvet, you can't kill yourself with a duvet.
Yeah, so...
But she was trying to find a way to do it.
And yeah, and she was on 24/7 suicide watch, so she'd have to... that means you're watched all the time. You've got this little slit in your door and you're watched. And I was opposite her, and I remember trying to talk to the male officer, and he wouldn't turn around. So he was doing his job, but she was there unpicking her duvet as she was lying and trying to swallow as many threads as possible.
Was there any sort of reasonable ability for you to sit down with other inmates and chit-chat and eat together and that sort of thing?
I was locked up for 23 and a half hours a day, so no.
What happened in that other half hour then?
So that's when you go and get your lunch from the canteen and then you go back and sit in your
room. Why was it considered that you were such a risk? And, you know, you actually weren't in there for that long, but, I mean, I'm sure it felt like a long time, but, you know, it seems bizarre to keep you locked up like that.
Yeah, considering a lot of the arguments now for prisoners to rehabilitate, I could not see any of that going on. That was not evidence to me whatsoever. But also, they were arguing that they were operating under COVID regime. But really, after the reports have come out, it's due to lack of staffing, lack of training, and they're overcrowded and don't really know what they're doing.
Well, one of the things that made me laugh when you were doing your speech on Tuesday was saying how that incarcerating you probably had the opposite effect. It made you more radical.
Yeah, I said that going in. I remember, yeah, yeah. I was like, you are putting the wrong person inside. I was like, if anything, this is going to give me a kick up the arse.
Martin, what about this? Because that's not what prison is designed for, is it? To actually radicalise people. But it does happen. In fact, for many people, they're picking up skills in prison to, go on to all sorts of radical activities, including criminal activities outside.
Well, what I think is going on is we've got a version of what happened in Italy in the 1970s, which is a strategia di tensione. So what they know there's a mass movement developing, and of course there's going to be an economic crisis now. People are going to go into the streets.
Yeah, there already is, but it's going to get worse.
That's right.
Yeah.
And what happened in Italy was that the state had heavily infiltrated the radical movement, as they have here. The special demonstration squad have been infiltrating our movements for years. We know that. And what they did in Italy is they were trying to provoke conflict so that they could then bring in more and more repressive legislation, terrify the population. And of course, they were also planting bombs. The head of the Italian Supreme Court, Fernando Imposimato, he wrote a book which came out in 2012. He's dead now. His brother was killed by the mafia. And he said, the book's called La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, the Republic of the Unpunished Massacres. So I went to Bologna in the late 70s after the uprising in Bologna that had happened in 77. And then, of course, in 1980, there was a bomb in Bologna railway station, which is the Bologna was a communist voting. It was the most solid communist voting town in Italy. And the children of the communist leadership in the city were the Autonomi Operai, Lotta Continua, the more left-wing groups.
What you seem to be saying here, if I can cut a long story short, is the idea is that there is a backlash against oppressive laws and an oppressive economy as it grows up, and the idea is that the authorities want to actually capture that and use it for their own purposes.
That's right. So the kidnap of Aldo Moro, who was the Prime Minister of Italy, was supposedly carried out by the Brigata Rossa, but in actual fact was carried out by the state. And this is exactly this is all in the book by this lawyer.
What I'm saying is, it doesn't mean to say that the organisations opposing the government, even individuals like Jasmine are ineffective, or that they're somehow compromised, because they're absolutely. Their aim of their beliefs and the change they want to see is still there, isn't it? It's still very important.
These are genuine movements, but they're manipulated. And what they wanted to do was create as much conflict as possible. They were once I think Philip Whitehead said the right wing terrorists in Italy were glove puppets, the left wing terrorists were marionettes. So the Red Brigades was infiltrated by the state. Yeah. It was set up as a genuine organisation, genuinely independent, but it was manipulated.
To go back, if I can, to when you were saying about prisoners coming out radicalised, I do think it's very important to note that I am white and I was very supported and very privileged going in, and had a lot of support around me. And my experience of prison is probably so much different from my trans friends and my black friends. So me coming out radicalised isn't representative of how people come out all the time. Like the majority of the time, they come out and they're demoralized and they don't want to get involved. They don't want to engage. Yeah. They want to forget about it. And that's classic of a lot of the Kill the Bill defendants and the prisoners. Yeah. They just want to completely forget.
I suppose a lot of it depends on the spirit, really. Isn't it an attempt to try and break your spirit?
100%. 100%.
Was that the court, the prison, or all of it?
The whole process. I mean, the fact that they've dragged it out for over two... People are still being sentenced. So the fact they dragged it out for 2 years made people think that they were looking at 5 to 10 years with the riot charge, and then at the last minute dropping it to violent disorder or a fray. I think it says everything you need to know. They were hoping that people were going to be scared of the system, take a riot charge, plead guilty, and then go away for a long time. But they weren't. And then they would then drop it to violent disorder because they were that desperate for a conviction.
OK, well, let's go back to Tuesday evening and have a listen to another one of the excerpt from one of the speeches.
In the past few years, shown us one thing. It's that when we stand together, we are a force to be reckoned with. And with the outright damning Casey report about the Metropolitan Police that came out today, it's clear that when all is said and done, all we really have is each other. This year, make sure, leave no one behind. Challenge police violence if you see it. Check in with a person if you see them being stopped and searched. Again, if you see violence in action, just challenge the police, film the police, and help your community take action against police misconduct. Bristol Cop Watch is all of us. It's everyone here. This year, let's show the police what time it is. Fight for your rights. And I always say, always stand up to your police. No justice, no peace! They are amazing. No justice! No peace! No justice! No peace! No justice! No peace!
I rather like that. We have something called Bristol Cop Watch, and the idea of filming something I definitely would approve of generally. I mean, if you see the police doing something, maybe arresting somebody, it's not a bad idea to film. And I can remember we were up in a situation a few years ago in Clifton where a building had been squatted and occupied for a weekend conference, and on the Friday a whole load of builders turned up who had been using some of the grounds to store stuff, told to come up there and get us out by the people that were renting the place, and it hadn't been used for years. And so there was an enormous confrontation with about 50 squatters and people who had come for this housing conference, and another 50 builders. It started to get rather nasty, and there was one policeman stood in the middle trying to say, no, and he saw me filming, and he said, make sure you film everything. And he made it clear to both sides, said, look, this is evidence we've got here, so if anyone starts kicking off, it'll be evidence used against you. This is the policeman. I thought, oh, no, they're going to come for me now. But actually, by filming, what you can do is calm a situation down, and that situation was calmed down. I mean, sometimes you might inflame a situation by filming, but nowadays we've got these... what do you make of all of this? Because we've got... Most people have got a phone now. When should you get your phone out and start filming, and when not, do you think?
At protest, never. I'm really on the fence about this, because a lot of the footage that I took saved my skin in my trial, but then was used against other defendants during their trial. So
did you have to hand the footage over?
They confiscated my phone, yeah.
Oh.
And then went through a lot
they
of
They just
my...
took the stuff off the phone, because this is the thing with many journalists. They will hand... they will sell. Let's be quite frank about it. Sell bits of footage to the local TV. They will sell photographs to the newspapers. But a good journalist will go through there and say, well, I want to make sure that there's nothing incriminating in these photos before... Because we can't pretend that the demonstration's not happened. We can't have actually no photos of it. And particularly when a lot of this evidence seems, Martin, to point towards what the police are doing. I mean, the demonstration which took place a little after this one was absolutely horrific. It was a peaceful demonstration outside the council house, and it was about 9 or 10 o'clock in the evening. 100 or so riot police just came round the corner out of the blue, even though they'd been told they can stay the night, and laid into them. This is the sort of time where you do need to film.
Yeah, well, I think I'm generally in favour of filming things, because it's all evidence. And if you're going to fight, you've got to be prepared to do it in a different.
Evidence is going to be used by this Judge Jeffries, whatever his name is, to put people inside for 5.5 years.
Well, this is because it's all been politicised, hasn't it? I mean, the whole purpose of bringing.
Well, maybe you should put your camera away then.
Well, if you're going to do that, you're going to do it, but then you've got to realise you don't want to be standing right next to the police when you do that. I mean, there hasn't been any rioting in Northern Ireland for years because the provos have forbidden it.
I would encourage deleting all footage if it's not helpful as soon as you get home. I mean, because it does tame, in some ways it does tame the police, or it suggests to them, okay, we are watching you, we've got eyes on you. But then if you're at risk of getting your phone confiscated or something, then you need to get rid of all of that.
Well, you know what, yeah. Martin Booth from Bristol 24/7 did it, I thought, was an excellent... piece. He filmed, I think it was for about 4 or 5 hours, but then what he did is anything that he thought might be used by the police to put people inside got edited out, and so it kind of jumped a bit. But what you've got is I think it's about 2.5 hours altogether. You can actually see the whole way that the whole demonstration progresses from start to finish, and the police don't come out of it very well at all. Anyway, look, it's all very well protesting against things, right? We all love to sort of shake a fist at whatever it is, authorities. We think they're no good, and most of the time, they're not any good. But what about the world you want to see? What about, an alternative way of doing things? Because you can't just get rid of the police. You can't just get rid of the state, can you?
Well, that's a big question, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
I mean, from my experience in prison, there were so many inmates that if their problems were solved whilst they were in the community, they wouldn't have resulted in crime. There were so many issues where, unfortunately, the state didn't intervene soon enough, and therefore crime was committed. I think a lot of the, when we say defund the police, what we're saying is actually distribute a lot of this money towards mental health services, towards housing. So many of the women in there were in there for self-defense or ABH or GBH, and so many of it could have been preventable if they were offered correct support. And so many in there as well should have been needed mental health support. I mean, the four deaths that happened in there were it was our inmates who should have been in a mental health facility and should have been looked after, as opposed to being demonised and criminalised and therefore ended up dying.
Well, if you have a chat to the cops informally, they will tell you that they're absolutely fed up to the eye teeth of having to deal with mental health problems. I mean, we had an incident at my housing scheme where one of the residents was mentally ill. He was setting fire to things, including dropping bits of paper down the stairwells that were alight, and nothing was done. Anyway, so the police tried eventually, because he set fire to the whole place. He set fire to his flat eventually, after a few months of warnings being unheeded by the housing association. And then the police said, well, we tried to charge him with arson, but the Crown Prosecution won't have it, and they've just put him in a nicer place to live. So you've got a bizarre situation where the Crown Prosecution are you know, because of this, the mental health facilities aren't out there, there's more and more people falling into this trap of crime. Some are ending up in prison, and the police are spending a lot of time on these cases, and sometimes they don't even end up in court.
Mm.
Martin?
Well, I mean, we've got an ongoing social breakdown that's been going on really since the 80s.
Isn't it all this about 2008? And as the money for all these other services is pulled, the money for the police,
goes back further than that. Obviously, there's, you know, we're going further and further down this road.
We're talking about the bailouts, really.
Well, the bailouts of the banks, yeah. There's been
a withdrawal of funding for local authorities, hasn't there?
Yes,
ever since
course,
the Cameron government.
Massive.
Slowly but surely, it's going down to virtually zero.
It was going down in the 80s. I mean, it's just more of the same stuff, and getting worse all the time.
I mean, what Jasmine's saying here is almost everything seems to be going except the police.
Well, that's right, because don't forget, during the years of austerity, the life expectancy in this country has gone down. It's the same thing happened in Russia during the transition crisis. Massive increase in preventable deaths.
Well, you look at the billions that have been funded into building the mega prisons, as what Truss is what deemed them as years ago. The fact that shows, if anything, that our government's stance on how we're going to deal with people who are mentally ill. There is no rehabilitation or funding going into the community. It's saying we need to build more prisons because, as far as we're concerned, we're just going to criminalise them. So let's build more spaces for that. That says everything that you need to know about how they want to deal with people who are mentally unwell and who are people who need
with
help.
With all the social problems that we face, I mean, obviously the ridiculous laws about the drugs trade. I mean, that is a massive driver of crime and disorder of all kinds. And this is straightforward. I mean, in Portugal, they legalised all drug possession in the 1980s. So that's taken a huge pressure off the police. So they don't have to go around busting
people.
So
kids can just go
smoking
and buy their heroin down the sweet shop, can they?
Well, no. What happens is if you're addicted to heroin, then you should just be given it. That's what used to happen in the 1960s in this country. And when Ahmadinejad was mayor of Tehran, you know, Muslim fundamentalist, he said, well, obviously, if people are addicted to heroin, we've just got to give it to them until they're ready to give it up.
Also, there's a difference between legalising something and decriminalising something.
Yes,
I think that's a very important distinction to make.
There is. I think it needs to be ultimately legalised, because that's the way to break the illegal markets behind it. But the illegal markets behind the drugs trade are funded by the intelligence services. MI6 and the CIA funded the insurgency in Afghanistan in the 1980s by turning a blind eye to heroin
on the streets of Britain. Talking a little bit about Vietnam and that role of that the drugs trade over the years.
Alfred
and
McCoy, the politics of heroin.
And Iran-Contra after the break, a bit later on with Ian Henshaw. Anyway, final clip from the demo on Tuesday now.
I want to end my speech with a little segment from my diary from prison. I wrote this on the second day of my incarceration. Doesn't work, fun fact. I am reminded that my close family do not live far away. I am reminded that the reason I am inside is bigger than me. I hope Judge Patrick is sleeping comfortably. I am cold, hungry, dehydrated, and shitting like no other. Anyway. I am opposite a woman who tried to kill herself just now with duvet threats. The system is broken, but I am not. See you tomorrow, bright and early. Wake up forever!
Yeah, I like the way you finished that cheers, gang. And it really just sort of, I mean, it's much different to some of these rather stultified sort of Socialist Worker Party type demonstrations, and very, very lively. But I'm going to ask you again about your, you know, do you think that the voting system is a way to change things? Because, you know, the system does seem to be broken nowadays, where we've got sort of the puppet on the left or the puppet on the right to vote for now.
I mean, No, I've lost all faith entirely, to be honest. In fact, I've moved more towards community-based projects and working with niche grassroots, you know, organisations, because I've just completely lost faith in, like, the party politics, essentially.
Yeah, it seems to be run by money. 100%. Money just buys up, whether it's a press that's the press that's criticising or political parties that's criticising. They just seem to get bought, and it seems very, very easy to do that with. And we're going to hear a clip now from Simon Killane, who I spoke to a few weeks ago. He's got a take on this, where he thinks actually everyone is got their price. I like to think I've not got my price. I think most of us in this room would say no, you can't buy me. But it's true, a lot of people are. And he gives a really good example here of a woman that he was campaigning to help, and then someone came along, gave her some money, and then she was one of his most vociferous. She became one of his most vociferous opponents.
Of course there's an effort there, and it's obvious there's an effort. This is the other crazy part of it. I mean, you know, this is there's a very difficult side of this. I remember going into a pub, you know, and they're watching, there's a load of guys, you know, tradesmen and plumbers and electricians and all that. They're all watching the TV, and on the TV it's all about, you know, the moats and the politicians basically ripping everybody off and all that stuff. And I go into the toilets, and I'm standing next to another guy in the urinals, and he's chatting to me, and he looks at me and says, "Simon, why don't you accept all this off these people? I would." So the same guy is out telling everybody, "Oh, it's terrible, the politician." People in my town would readily have said to me, "Yeah, go for it, get the money, join the Freemasons, take it." And a lot of them said, "You're better off. There'll be less trouble for you, Simon, and your family." So unfortunately, there's a real problem here that you know, and the other problem you've got very, 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 very simply is, you know, a developer wants to build houses on a swamp, far away from a town, none of the amenities and so on. But it happens to be there's a little cottage that's owned by some old lady, and she's totally environmental. She loves the community she's lived in, all that sort of stuff. Somebody knocks at her door and says to her, "I'll give you £1 million for your cottage because I need it for an access to a development." She says, "Where's that development?" "Oh, it's over here." "But that's not good. When I farm the land, it's swamps and water and all that kind of stuff. Not the right place." The problem you have is the minute I pop up and go, "Well, this is not the right way to do this," she'll be one of the people out there with a placard going, "Get rid of this councillor," because she's thinking, "I've just been offered £1 million. What about my children, my grandchildren? They can now have their own property. And people get bought. It's very, very easy to buy people. Much easier than I ever thought. You know, and we all know this. We all know this. And so that's the other problem you've got. If you have a system which is clearly biased towards money being the tool to get what you want, then you can buy most people off. And the ones you can't buy off, you will either try to destroy or get rid of.
Well, that's Simon Killane there, and he indeed was destroyed, had his marriage smashed to pieces, his name besmirched in all the newspapers locally, threats against his children at school, and all because he had upset a few landowners who wanted to build some buildings in Malmesbury, where on their own land. And this was something that the people didn't really want to do in the town, and he challenged that. And I've just got a... message from the National Union of Journalists in Bristol. In fact, I was surprised not to get any reply when I tried to call James Garrett, who's the chair of the NUJ in Bristol branch, yesterday. He says he's got a response. He says to this letter, which I'll put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, which is really warning journalists not against problems from the police and being attacked by the police, which is what happened at the Kill the Bill and that whole series of demonstrations, but actually against the demonstrators. So what he says is, of course, the National Union of Journalists seeks to protect its members who do their jobs in the public interest. It has spoken up for members who've suffered at the hands of police and in several instances taken legal action successfully. It also seeks to protect members from violence and threats from a minority of protesters. So that's a response from the National Union of Journalists. Thanks very much for that, James, ex-head of News and Current Affairs at HTV and producer of some terrific documentaries. One is one on Gloucestershire Freemasons, and another one is James's documentary on the Merchant Venturers, which is by far, I think, the best. And you can seek those out if they haven't been taken down off YouTube as a result. But also, this whole business of the police was discussed because of the Casey report coming out this week into the Metropolitan Police at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Mr. Speaker, but the Prime Minister stands there and pretends that everything's fine. He is so totally out of touch. He needs to get out of Westminster, get out of Kensington, and I don't mean to Malibu, to the streets of Britain. Go there and tell people it's all fine and see what reaction he gets. The answer he didn't want to give, although he knows it, is 4% of cases, 4% of burglary charges are charged. 96% of theft and burglary cases not even going before the courts. Burglars twice as likely to get away with it now as they were a decade ago. They should be ashamed of that record. And that cul-de-sac in Armthorpe has apparently seen 10 burglaries in 18 months, but only one of them has resulted in a prosecution. So rather than boasting and blaming others, why doesn't he tell the country when he's going to get the theft and burglary charge rate back to where it was before they wrecked policing?
Prime Minister. Mr. Speaker, first of all, let me say North Yorkshire's a lot further away than North London. Mr. Speaker, since the Conservatives came into power, crime is down 50%, Mr. Speaker. Violent crime down 40%. Burglary, the Honourable Gentleman mentioned burglary. Burglary down 56%. Why? Because we've recruited 20,000 more police officers. We've given them the powers to tackle crime, and we've kept serious offenders in prison for longer. All they've done is vote against greater protections for emergency workers. They've opposed tougher sentences for violent criminals, and they are failing to give the police the powers that they need. It's the same old Labour, soft on crime, soft on criminals.
Yeah. So that's Labour leader Keir Starmer tackling the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak from Goldman Sachs in the Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday. What do you make of these exchanges, Jasmine, at the House of Commons on Prime Minister's Question Time? Is there really any point? I mean, he's actually putting some interesting statistics there about, you know, well, I mean, in fact, the statistics sort of fly in the face of each other. One person is saying one thing, the other person is saying something completely different.
Yeah, it's, to be honest, the exchanges sounded very vapid and superficial, to be honest. But also they're looking at like crime statistics, and they're never really addressing the root of the problem. And so they're saying that Tory government has lowered the amount of crime, but Tory government is what creates criminals in that they are pushing people to desperation and to their limits where they have to resort to crime. The statistics of saying it's been lowered is a joke.
Reported crimes. It's a difference between reported crime and actual crime.
It's completely socially constructed.
Well, and also, I think one of the things we can all agree on is there's been an absolute chasm since 2010 open up between rich and poor, with people like Sunak given all sorts of excuses to basically squirrel away their wealth.
But they're talking about harshening sentences. But look at the reoffending rates. People come out and there's no support for criminals. I hate to use that word, but for people that leave prison and then they're back within prison within the same, statistically within a week, and it's horrendous. So why aren't they addressing why they're not supporting people going back into the community? There's something fundamentally wrong with the society's structure if people are being forced to reoffend.
Can I just point out that as a result of George Osborne's austerity policy, 20,000 police officers who were experienced and had been in the job for years were sacked. And the police themselves were saying, what's this about? The bankers, Goldman Sachs, they were bailed out. We had the money to invade Libya. We had the money to intervene in Syria. But apparently we couldn't afford any police officers. And then they wonder why they can't control the so-called crime. And of course, I totally take your point that crime is a social construction. You know, if you push communities to the limit, then you're going to find, for example, young meat people trying to make money selling drugs because they can't find anything else to do. And then they're criminalised, then they end up in prison and all the rest of it. And of course, the underlying all of this is the banking system. In 2008, when the banking system wobbled, there's a UN report on drugs and crime. What happened there? The drug cartels went straight to the banks and said, you need some money, don't you? You're having a panic. Said, good, do you know what? We've got some. And it was just sucked into the system in one go, just like that. And of course, the banking system was bailed out by the drug cartels. And that was all accepted by the powers that be because they're in on it.
One of the things this week, which also came up, was the releasing, at the same time as Boris was being questioned about Partygate, of the Prime Minister's tax returns. Very interesting, the timing of it. And it was good to hear Julia Hartley Brewer on Talk Radio actually giving Jacob Rees-Mogg, one of our local Tories with his lovely big top hat, a hard time about that.
Rishi Sunak published a summary of his tax return, released interestingly at 4 o'clock, right in the middle of Boris Johnson's Evidence to Privileges Committee. Good day to bury bad news, some of us have suggested. It revealed that he earned almost £5 million in the last 5 years. He's paid about £1 million in tax. His tax rate, 20%, because lots of his earnings are from a blind trust in the United States, in which he pays only capital gains tax, means that his tax rate is effectively lower than many people on very much more average salaries in this country.
Well, I don't think that we should criticise people for having worked hard and made a success of their lives. Rishi Sunak is an absolute exemplar of that, and his parents before him, who they worked very hard for the sake of their children. Isn't that what life is about parents working hard so that their children have a better standard of living than they do? And isn't that what government is about, ensuring this happens for as many people, if not all people in the country, as far as we possibly can? That's how economic policy should be devised, to help the next generation to be better off than this generation.
And do you think that the government and the policies they followed and the government that you've served in has done that for millions of people in this country?
Well, I think
poorer,
that's absolutely been the aim. Well, that what we have been doing was hit by COVID. COVID closed down the economy for the best part of a year, so inevitably that had a strong economic effect. But I think Brexit is one of the most beneficial economic things we could do, because it means we're making our own decisions, we can get the supply side reforms, the deregulations that allow the economy to thrive, and we break out of the dead regulatory hand of the European Union. I think that's really exciting and positive.
Well, there's the old top hat himself from isn't it East Harptree? He's supposed to be down here somewhere, down near the lakes, very close to here anyway, Chew Magna area. Martin, your take on that, because he's saying all sorts of things in one there. Actually, the reason that there's so many poor people around is because of Brexit, and also, of course, COVID. Well, actually, no, he's saying Brexit is a great opportunity, isn't he?
Well, obviously, I mean, he's saying nothing that you wouldn't expect him to say. And, of course, the whole idea that of trickle-down, that wealthy people
has
making
Rishi
money
Sunak,
is good for everybody, is just rubbish.
Has Rishi Sunak worked hard?
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
That's a fallacy, isn't it? That having a load of money means you've worked hard, you know, far from it. The only work he did to get that money was to choose the right woman to marry, according to what one reads in the papers about his wife's immense wealth.
The other point is, as Michael Hudson points out, the US economist, is the financialisation of the economy since the Big Bang in the 1980s in the City of London has led to people making more money from speculative investments, which don't actually end up being invested in anything. It's just financial engineering.
It's the rentier economy.
It's a rentier economy. And, of course, this is exactly what... I mean, in China, the banking system is owned by the government, and they've got no intention of changing that. In Russia, the arms industry is owned by the government, and they've got no intention of changing that, because that is actually the way to run it.
In Britain, the government is owned by the banking system.
That's right. And that's why, and of course, it ultimately it undermines the productivity of your economy. The Germans are going to be put through the mill now because of the blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline by the Americans. They are going to be deindustrialized. and they're going to be pushed into being what's going to happen is we're going to become more like the United States of America. Our big cities are going to become more like Chicago, and in the United States it's going to become more like Colombia, where, you know, and of course the criminalization of the world economy, the banking system, the financial derivatives market and all the rest of it is probably about to crash, and the drugs economy, which is not just tolerated, it's key to the strategies of the Western intelligence services. It always has been.
I remember George Osborne bringing in the whole idea of organised crime proceeds into the GDP when he was Chancellor.
That's right, because they were trying to boost the GDP.
Trying to get the GDP.
So they said, well, let's estimate how much prostitution and drugs, because of course it is important. The criminal economy is a key part of the British economy.
Jasmine, are there any lights at the end of the tunnel that you youngsters are seeing in amongst all this doom and gloom? Because it is a bit depressing. If you look at the economy, it seems that divide between rich and poor is almost as if the government is in there with a crowbar, making it bigger.
I think apparently we're all too distracted by our avocado on toast, so we don't really know what to say, do we?
You haven't got a mortgage yet,
with
you?
No. Devastating.
Owning nothing and being happy, that's where we're all going, apparently. But anyway, look, you mentioned Michael Hudson, and in the doom and gloom, you can look at, I think, his idea, socialist economist, who's actually a professor in both Chinese universities and in US universities, quite a unique character, really, I think, an absolutely amazing chap. In his his book, it's called The Destiny of Civilization, Finance Capitalism, Industrial Capitalism, or Socialism. He talks about this idea of the Western economy being exactly like the fall of Rome.
It's not simply the United States and its European satellites on the one hand versus the non-white population on the other hand. It's finance capitalism versus the rest of the world, which is protecting itself by socialism, which in many ways fulfills what was the ideal of industrial capitalism during the 19th century, when industrial capitalism was actually progressive. And it was progressive. That's part of the whole theme of my book. It was revolutionary. It tried to free economies from the legacy of feudalism, from the legacy of hereditary landlords. And now the financial class is no longer the landlord class, but the financial class. And the landlord class pays most of its rent to the financial class in the form of mortgage interest, as it borrows money to buy property and housing and commercial sites on credit. And you have the kind of financialization that has increased housing prices in the United States to over 40% of income that is officially guaranteed for mortgages, that has priced American labor out of the market, privatized healthcare, 18% of GDP. That's pricing America out of the world market. Debt for car, auto debt, student debt, which in other countries, education is free. That's pricing America out of the market. So you have a basically uncompetitive economy that's committing financial suicide following the same dynamic that destroyed the Roman Empire, where an predatory oligarchy took over and maintained power by an assassination policy of its critics, just very similar to what America has been doing in Latin America and other countries. So you're having history repeat itself with this same kind of world split. And this split couldn't have occurred back in the 1970s. There was the Bandung Conference in Indonesia. There were other attempts at the non-aligned nations to break free of American imperialism, but they didn't have a critical mass. So right now, for the first time, you have a critical mass, and you have the ability of China, Iran, Russia, India, other countries together to be self-sufficient. They don't need relations with the United States. They can handle their own, they can create their own monetary system outside of the International Monetary Fund, which is basically an arm of the Defense Department. They can give loans to build up the infrastructure of countries outside of the World Bank, which is basically an arm of the Defense Department, the deep state. So you have the American economy, essentially a merger between the military-industrial complex and the Wall Street financial fire sector, finance, insurance, and real estate, is a way that really cannot develop any more than the Roman Empire could develop by trying to obtain militarily what it could not produce at home anymore. Well, China and other countries, now that they have their industrial base, the raw materials, the food ability to feed themselves, the agriculture, and the technology, they can go their own way. And so we're seeing in the last few months the beginning of a war that's going to go on for, I think, 20 years, maybe 30 or 40 years. The world is splitting away, and it won't be a pretty sight because the United States and its European satellites are trying to fight to prevent an inevitable breakaway that it cannot prevent any more than Europe's landlord class could prevent industrial capitalism from developing in the 19th century.
So that's Michael Hudson there. His book, absolutely brilliant. I haven't actually read the whole thing. No, I've had a look at bits and pieces of it. And he does some terrific interviews on it. But it's called The Destiny of Civilization, Finance Capitalism, Industrial Capitalism, or Socialism? And really, he's arguing for a mixed economy. That's the sort of stuff I grew up with in the 1960s and 1970s here, where you had the government managing the infrastructure of the country and the entrepreneurs trying to get on and build a better widget. And now, of course, those entrepreneurs are so-called entrepreneurs. Are just parasiting off of our infrastructure. That's what they seem to be doing anyway. Martin, banks have been dragging European markets down today amid Deutsche Bank woes. Deutsche Bank became the latest financial firm to start putting traders on edge. Britain's biggest markets all dropped in value as uncertainty once again rippling through. It comes after particular worries because the bond markets apparently are the ones that are getting nervous. People are pulling out of bonds because Credit Suisse, people who were bondholders in Credit Suisse, lost their money.
Yeah, I mean, it's because we've had very, very low interest rates and quantitative easing for over a decade now. And that's created huge bubbles, speculative bubbles in property, in the stock market.
Basically, because it's kind of free to borrow money.
That's
if you
right.
can convince the bank to let you have
that's
it,
right.
it's
and
almost
of course
free.
It leads to
the banks were borrowing money for 0.5% and lending it out for 5%.
That's right.
I mean, you couldn't
greedy.
Lose.
They're greedy. That's one of the reasons why they got into trouble, just being greedy. But of course, if you're not greedy in a competitive market, somebody else will be greedy and then you're undercut.
Yeah.
So it's the policy that's been pursued. And of course, they've got to raise interest rates, or they think they have, in order to deal with inflation because they don't what else to do. But of course, at that point, the banks become insolvent. And I suspect what's going to happen now is that there's going to be a banking crash in the West. But the Russians and the Chinese
will
have
they
done
it?
Enough
will
that they won't be affected in
will
the same way.
Will they bail it out like they did in 2008?
Well, they will try.
They will have to.
But the problem with that is that they can't then... They're not necessarily going to be able to... The European Central Bank is not allowed... They've got to raise interest rates. It's in the constitution of the European Central Bank. Federal Reserve can probably, and the Bank of England could probably pump more money in, but the Bank of England this week decided it was going to go with increasing interest rates.
So
this is they're between a rock and a hard place.
Today, Deutsche Bank shares have dropped by more than 14%. In a day, midday Friday, and credit default swaps, which are used by Deutsche's bondholders as insurance, should it fail, soared in price. So, you know, anyone that's sort of expecting Deutsche Bank to go down is now having to pay a lot more money for their insurance. So it's clearly, you know, the markets are saying, well, actually, Deutsche Bank is no longer safe as a bank.
What we're looking at is a very similar situation to in 2008, except the bubbles are that much bigger. And they don't really know what to do. What they hoped to do was crash the Russian economy as a result of the war.
So the takeover
in Ukraine,
takeover,
and then they would be able to collateralize all of the raw materials in Siberia.
I mean, it sounds
but
to me a bit.
They can't go there.
The domino effect, doesn't it? So
that's
the takeover
happen, yeah.
of Credit Suisse last week. We had on Monday a big announcement. Oh, it's all everything's going to be final. Was it Sunday evening? I think that what they're saying here in crikey, what is this public? Oh gosh! The Independent is that the idea that the takeoff of Credit Suisse was going to put on the lid of the crisis by the end of the week, it's out the window.
Yeah, well, what the
dominoes?
What the main, you know, what the central bankers and the politicians and the finance ministers are trying to do now is don't panic. But of course, that is exactly where people start to think, hang on a minute, why are you saying that? And the possibility of a big banking collapse is definitely there. And of course, they won't be able to bail it out because it's too big. Yeah, it's just too much. They can't. If they're going to insure all federal all deposits in the U.S., which is what happened with the Silicon Valley Bank, they said anything under $250,000 was insured. But of course, a lot of people in the tech entrepreneurs who had their money in the bank, they've got far more than that in there. So they started taking their money out because they realised it wasn't insured. Then Biden says, no, we'll insure all of it. And Biden was saying this week, well, every bank deposit in the US is insured. But of course, they haven't got the money to cover it.
Yeah. Well, this is the amazing thing.
They haven't got the resources to
cover
it.
Where do the bailouts come from?
Well, they can print money, and they probably will. But even so, you see, there's too many deflationary pressures in the world.
It sounds to me a bit like a game.
I don't see hyperinflation out of anything.
It sounds like they're almost playing a game here, Martin, and making things up as they go along. Actually, the whole sector is crooked, corrupt. It's not actually viable. And what about inflation? This week they've increased inflation here in the UK.
The inflation was higher than they expected.
Interest rate. So why are they? It seems to me that the inflation, obviously, that is putting extra money onto people's business loans. It's putting extra money onto people's mortgages. Surely the increase in interest rates is bound to cause inflation. There's some argument that they try and put out there saying, "Oh no, we need to have a bit of more higher interest rates because that will stop inflation." It doesn't. It seems to be totally the opposite.
Well,
could it be that they've got it completely, back to
front? Well, yeah, they have. I mean, what happened was that we suddenly started having to pay three times as much for oil and gas, entirely their fault because it was they who boycotted Russia and not the other way around, as they're now trying to pretend. So that went up by 30%. What they could easily have done is to have taken that money off the companies that made it, and then we wouldn't have had the price. They could have just compensated people with that money, and we wouldn't have inflation to any degree at all in comparison.
Well, what's interesting with the blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline is the Norwegians were involved in that, and they've got a nationalised oil industry. Statoil is owned by the Norwegian government. So in actual fact, they are making a packet out of the collapse of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. And of course, in Norway, that money will be used to compensate
the
ordinary people
out there, but no,
for the increases in oil prices, because it's a nationalised industry.
Yeah. Anyway, does anyone know what roughly food price inflation is at now?
I think 16% or something like that.
Very good. Go to the top of the class. 16%, which is massive, really.
And of course,
if you think
poorer people spend more of their money on food than richer people.
So the basic
that affects them far more than wealthier people.
Isn't it funny how the yachts don't seem to have gone up too much in price, but food has? Funny that.
Kurt Osborne.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The new inflation stats this morning show food inflation is at 18%, the highest in 45 years. Millions are living in food and fuel poverty because of this government's failures and political decisions to enable grotesque profiteering at the expense of our communities. How on earth can the Prime Minister claim his plan is working, or is it a success in his eyes that so many people are struggling with their weekly food shop?
Mr. Speaker, the figures that have been recently published showed that since 2010, there are 2 million fewer people living in poverty, thanks to the actions of this and previous Conservative governments. Of course, no one wants to see people struggling with week-to-week bills like food, which is why it's so imperative we stick to our economic plan. And as the OBR have said, we are on track to halve inflation by the end of this year. That is the most important thing we can do to ease a burden on people. And in the meantime, we have a range of programmes, whether that's free school meals or indeed the holiday activities and food programme, to provide support to the most vulnerable families who need our help.
2 million fewer people in poverty, so it's all right then.
Well, it's just there's not lies, damned lies and statistics, isn't there? It's quite clear that the direction of travel has been the impoverishment and deindustrialisation of Europe, including Britain, and that's where we're going. And that will have all sorts of knock-on effects.
Well,
one
of the knock-on effects I was observing the other day, driving over past the Downs up in Bristol, something like 60 or 70 vans, caravans, people just living up on the Downs now. They're parking their vehicles, they're living in their vehicles, because the rents are far too high.
Well, in the United States of America, I said earlier that we're going to get more like the United States of America. In the United States of America, lots of people live in tent cities and in vehicles. It's normal stuff. It's been normal stuff for years over there. And that's what we're going to, that's where we're going. And that's what life is going to be like in Britain.
I think it's worth mentioning as well, essentially it's nomad land And it, what that encourages is more community support as well. So you're like, obviously there's a comment on rent increases and being able to afford houses. But also if you look at the way of life when you live in vans and what van life is like, and the community is much more squatter friendly and much more, it's just community family based, and the morals of that. I think that's what's more, again, more attractive to a lot of people for living reasons. And
I mean, even in Victorian times, you know, when the people were oppressed by the system, by the state financially, actually what it does is in a way drives them closer together, doesn't it?
Well, it can do, and obviously that's the sort of thing we need to organise if we want that to happen. But there's a negative side, you know. I mean, I remember when the crisis first came in 2008, I went to a conference organised by the anarchists in Bristol, and they were talking about how we can deal with this crisis by learning how to live out of skips. Now, I'm perfectly happy for people to adapt, but we also need to change the policy leading to that needs to be challenged. I'm afraid I'm an old-fashioned socialist. The government needs to do stuff. You can't just expect people to magically resolve the issues that they're being thrown into. Although, of course, there are creative responses as well. It's not just there's no reason to just sit on your hands.
I think it's sad how resilient and how adaptive we need to become in order to survive in our country, though.
In Latin America, I was trade union delegation to Colombia in 2005, and many people in Colombia do not have any kind of regular work at all. 7 million people have been displaced by the conflict in Colombia. They've got the biggest number of refugees in the world.
So how are they surviving then?
Well, what happens is people do, in fact, create community organisations to defend themselves, and they're very creative about it. And the trade union movement in Colombia organises less than 5% of the population, but they become a focal point for the disenfranchised poor. So in the early 2000s, they wanted to privatise the MCARLI, it was called in Cali, which is the municipal workers who do things like electricity infrastructure and drains. And they were trying to sack them. And what the trade unions used to do in Cali, they used to go every Sunday, once a month, they would go into the barrios and do work for free to help the community. So they'd connect them to electricity, they'd put in drains for them for free. And when they tried to sack the MCARLI employees over Christmas, they occupied their buildings in the centre of the two towers. And then the police, they were surrounded by the riot police and the army. And then all the people from the barrios came down and surrounded the army and the riot police, because these people had helped them over many years and they weren't going to seem put down. So that's what they call social movement trade unionism in Latin America. And in Latin America, they've got a huge tradition of people who do not have formal work organising on the community level with the trade unions to try and build an alternative way of they've got to work from the bottom up, because they've got no other choice. And of course, they've got a huge tradition of that, which we haven't got. People are used to having stuff done for them or to them here. People are more prepared. They've got to do their own thing.
There's quite a lot of social movements here as well.
Latin America is, if you want to look at social movement organisation, Latin America
the
is
sharp
the
end or the sharp toe of the boot of the empire there, haven't they?
Well, that's right. And because of the struggles over many, many years, they've become very, I was talking to Ian earlier about AMLO, who's López Obrador, who's the president of Mexico. He made a barnstorming speech this week in the center of Mexico to a big rally, saying that the Americans are threatening to invade Mexico to deal with the drug cartels. And he said, don't even think about it. And he was linking his presidency to that of Cárdenas, Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas in the 1930s, who nationalised the oil industry in Mexico. Yeah. And he's also saying, who bombed the Nord Stream 2 pipeline? That was you, wasn't it, in the United States of America? So that's what he was, he was accusing the US of basically starting World War III. And this is, he's a very popular politician in Mexico. And you can see all over Latin America that you've now got a push back from the left in virtually every country.
Well, one of the things I'd say in response to that is we had a clip earlier this year in a longer interview I did at the end of last year with Kees van der Peel, who's someone I'd thoroughly recommend. His book is States of Emergency, Keeping the Global Population in Check. His basic thesis is that the power elites around the world know that as they take over politics, they take over the various financial systems of the Western world particularly, that there's going to be a kickback, and that that they are going to try and control that kickback by more draconian laws and by more authoritarian measures right around the Western world. So that states of emergency, keeping the global population in check, book well worth having a look at from Kees van der Peel. And things seem to be a little bit advanced, actually, from what we're putting up with in France this week, as we've seen a whole load of demonstrations, particularly in Paris, and announcement today that King Charles is going to have to cancel his visit to Paris next week or in a couple of weeks' time.
It was on Sunday, but he's not going.
He's not going. No, he's deciding he's not going now. And actually, Macron announced that he'd advised him not to go, although I wonder whether Charles is just biting his nails a little bit, looking at the TV of burning police vehicles and things like that over in Paris. But here's there hasn't been really very good reporting of it over here. There's been some reasonable reporting of it in France, but I had a hunt around for a decent report, and the best one I could find was on the Qatari English language Al Jazeera.
Nationwide strike and protest day, the ninth since the beginning of the year, and that's affecting across the public sector, transport hubs, education, health services. Garbage is still piling up in Paris. A lot of anger over President Macron's pension reform bill, which will raise the retirement age. But not only that, people are now angry over the method by which President Macron's government pushed this bill through Parliament, bypassing lawmakers and MPs. They forced it through by decree. People say that just shows that President Macron, not only does he not care about people in the street and their concerns, but he also doesn't care about France's institutions, they say, about lawmakers, about opposition and critics, that he only cares about what he wants.
And interestingly, he was saying that what he wants is progress for the country in his televised address, and that he doesn't care about his popularity because he can't run for president again.
President Macron is under a lot of pressure socially and politically. Look, politically, it was just a few days ago that Macron's government just about survived a no-confidence motion in Parliament by just a few votes because of the level of anger and opposition and criticism in the Parliament. Now, that's going to make it very difficult to go forward with other legislation in the future because there are so many divisions in Parliament and so much animosity towards the government and President Macron. President Macron says that this reform is fundamental in order to sustain the pension system for the future. As you said, he says, I don't care about my popularity. What's important is my duty to the country. He said those things in a television interview. But that interview has really added fuel to the fire, if you like, because he gave no concessions to any of his opponents. He said he wouldn't reshuffle his cabinet. He wouldn't, for example, change his prime minister. That has inflamed tensions and passions even more, if you like. So it's very interesting to see which way things are going to go. The government and Macron, of course, would like these protests to fizzle out. But demonstrators are saying that even though this bill is on its way to becoming a law, they don't care. They're going to continue to go out in the streets because they want to put enough pressure on the government so that it scraps its reform.
Natasha, thank you very much for that. That is Natasha Butler joining us with the very latest from the protests in Paris.
A reporter, great name for a reporter, Natasha Butler, if that's really her name. But anyhow, so Martin, what do you make of this? There is obviously, I mean, there's the headlines today in France too are saying Macron's lost control.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think his speech to the nation, where he basically doubled down and said we're not giving way, because of course Macron can't be re-elected, so his powerful.
He's got nothing to lose. That's
he's
what
got
he's
nothing
said,
to
yeah.
lose. He's forcing this through on behalf of international capital, because that's what they want. And he's got no political future anyway, so he's prepared to go down with the ship in order to get this stuff through. But of course, he may have misjudged the mood completely, because the opinion polls show that 85% of the population do not agree raising the pension age.
There's a similarity between Macron and I remember seeing this brilliant thing when he was first elected, a French, because the French are very good at this sort of thing, where it had this thing, a picture of Macron looking a little bit sort of spaced out, very contrasty picture, saying "Le imposteur." They're saying that this guy's just an imposter right from the start. He's an ex-merchant banker.
That's right.
As is Rishi Sunak.
Yes, he's a very, very similar to Sunak, although in some respects, Sunak is more to the right than Macron, but they're very similar background because they're very much part of the financial elite.
And interesting that this should all erupt over pensions, something as supposedly mundane. No. Actually, this is one of the things that we noticed in the trade unions was you start having you have a meeting about pensions and suddenly all the members are there. You know, everyone gets out. That and car parking spaces were the two big things that caught the members out.
Well, I mean, when Macron says that it was in his manifesto that he was going to increase the pension age, you've got to remember that the French political system is a two-stage process. So they have at every level, you get a vote to decide who the two runoff candidates are, and then you get a runoff vote a week or two later. Now, people voted for Macron from the left to keep out Marine Le Pen from the right. But they didn't vote to have the pension age increased. They voted for him simply to keep her out. And interestingly enough, I was saying to Ian earlier, Marine Le Pen doesn't want to increase the pension age either because it's totally unpopular. French people do not want to retire later than 62. They have quite a high level of tax that they pay when they're in work. And the French have always valued free time. You know, they've got higher productivity per hour than Germany, but they've got lower GDP than Germany because they take long holidays. And the French have got make no apologies for that. What is the matter with spending time with my family? What is the matter with having a long summer holiday where I can play with my children? What is the matter? One of the protesters was carrying a sign saying, Granddad works till he drops and grandson on the dole. No thanks. So they want young people to have jobs, and the older people have got to retire. So the young people are going to have the jobs.
These things are going on. This uprising, I could call it, is going on right across France. Paris, nearly 500 were arrested yesterday, and the Interior Minister Gérard Damimian, I probably pronounced that wrong, but anyway, he said nearly 1,000 fires had to be put out by the authorities in Paris, just in Paris yesterday.
Well, what you've got in France is a culture whereby the mainstream protesters, the trade unionists and so on, they will march in a block, and then you've got others who, for all whatever reason, are going to go out and have a go at the police at the end of the demonstration. This is what used to happen in Northern Ireland. You have a demonstration, the women and children and the elderly go home, and then if the youth want to stay and have a fight, then they have a fight. And in actual fact, it's an accepted thing in France. You know, they know it's going to happen. And of course, if everybody's sensible, nobody gets really seriously hurt. But of course, they stopped doing this in Northern Ireland years ago because it's hard to control and people end up getting killed. And you know, this is the problem.
How far is Macron prepared to push this, do you think? And will he have to cave in eventually? Because, I mean, what's been happening is there have been specific individual days of protests. These protests are now running into almost every day.
Yeah, well, I think it's a most serious political crisis in France since 1968, isn't it? Quite clearly. And obviously in 1968, the place was brought to a standstill. But of course, the engagement of the mainstream of the population is bigger now than in 68.
Well, the problem in 68 was that the government had a counter demonstration and more people turned up on it than the opposition.
So in other words, the left was...
So the irony was that in the 60s, the left had the right idea, but the majority of the public was against them. Now, the left often have the wrong idea, the establishment left, that is, but the public have actually got a much better idea. The public now would seriously regret its move, you know, in the 60s.
Well, I think
what's
also happening is Marine Le Pen is trying to lead the Front National, I don't think it's even called that anymore, into being a more centrist formation. And to do that, she's got to appeal to middle France, and middle France don't want to have increased pension age. They don't want it.
Well, the French, basically, they have a tradition of, you know, insurrection, but frankly, you know, then look at the 19th century, revolution after revolution.
Well, that's right. And of course, I've been waiting for the French to do something like this since 2008.
Yeah, because the Brits, we've basically lived off our empire. And although you won't find any Brit in the street now who says, oh, well, I think we can live off our empire, that is the mentality still. You know, somebody else is going to make money for us. We're going to rent out our flat for our pension. I mean, mean, I have to admit, you know, that I think like that sometimes, you know, and we have this culture of imperialism, which is deep in our unconscious, and we really need to confront that.
Well, I mean, all of these strikes in France, general strikes, would be illegal under British trade union law.
Yeah.
The unions would have their funds sequestered. And that, you know, this is not people being sent to, they just take the money off you.
I mean, there comes a point, though, doesn't it, where the law doesn't it becomes impossible to implement the law.
Well, the point with the NUM in this country is that you can't. It's very hard to protect your funds. They can.
I mean, if you have to go underground,
that's why they haven't
ever managed to crack the tube strikers.
Yeah,
because they know that what will happen if they do make it illegal is it'll go completely underground, and suddenly just one day they won't turn up for work.
Well, that's right. That's what the tube strikers. But British trade unionism has developed quite a different set of tactics because of the different legal situation we're in. But in France, people will join a general strike. People who are not in any trade union at all will join a general strike. And their employers can try and victimise them, but they won't get away with it.
I'd like to leave the final word on this to Jasmine, if you don't mind. And I'd just like to hear from you what you make of what's been going on over in France and whether you think the Brits are up to the job.
I think we should take inspiration from their reactionary process to governmental implement. Like, we are pathetic in comparison, but they are proactive and reactive in equal measure, and I think that we need to be more engaged like them as well, and more in tune, and realize that we are stronger together and we need to take action.
Yeah, I suppose it's when it comes to your doorstep you start to think, oh right, maybe I'm gonna have to actually do something now. Anyway, what about your campaign for justice for the protesters? Whereabouts can people follow that and follow your stuff, etc., online, do you know?
Your best bet is following Bristol Anti-Repression Campaign, which was born out of the Kill the Bill protests. But then there's also Justice for Bristol Protesters, which is, again, basically trying to readdress the narrative of what happened on the 21st and 21. All on social media.
Okay, Jasmine York, thanks very much for joining us. Now, we're going to have a clip, which is Dr. Chris Busby, who I interviewed last week about depleted uranium. I have to say, well, I don't have to say anything, and I said that last week. You never have to say anything. But it was interesting to see our report last week on depleted uranium from Chris Busby. Suddenly, it went around the world. She and Putin were talking about depleted uranium for the first time since the Ukraine war started. And we're going to be hearing a bit more about that after the break. But now, here's Chris Busby talking about what he makes of the Green Party and their nuclear policy. Because if anyone checks what the Scottish Greens are up to, they're now pro-nuclear. They're saying we need to extend the lives of these nuclear reactors that we've got in Scotland and keep them going, even though they're actually designed to be closed down years ago.
Well, I think it's a nightmare. I mean, if it comes to that, look at that Green Party woman, what's her name, Annalena Baerbock, you know, and her position on Putin and the Ukraine and so forth. I think the Green Party has had it. Even when I was then, there was a real Green Party in the 90s. It was what we would call a Green Party, but it was real. They were clever people, and they discussed things, and they figured out what the best way forward would be and all the rest of it. And they were horrifyingly anti-nuclear, naturally enough. And it started as an anti-nuclear movement in Germany with Petra Kelly, who they assassinated. So what happened when I was there, and I watched it happen, was the infiltration of the Green Party. And you must expect that to happen, because the Green Party was one of the most anti-capitalist and pro-equality operations that existed at that time. And they had been doing quite well in the first European Parliament elections in 1989. So everybody was scared to death about them. And so what happened is they just infiltrated the party with a load of stooges. And I watched this all happen. I watched them slowly being pushed to the right, or pushed to, you know, the direction that have now gone pushed to. And so now, of course, we have the culmination of all of this nonsense with people like Monbiot, who was always a sleeper, and Mark Lynas and various other sort of worthies who are trying to push the idea of safe, peaceful, you know, nuclear power that will prevent global warming and save everybody and blah, blah, blah. So I have no time for the Green Party. Although I'm a member of it, but I ought to really resign and make a video about it, you know, and say what a bunch of a bunch of crooks they are now.
So do you think that that we are going to see a rollout of nuclear around the UK now? I mean,
they're going to try. I mean, what their idea is to use these, what they call small modular reactors. So, you know, every town has its own reactor. It's complete absurdity, the whole business. And incidentally, I know a lot about small modular reactors because I'm doing a big court case in Scotland now over a submarine guy who died of lymphoma who was on a submarine. And I wrote a paper which was published about cancer in US Navy sailors who operated on nuclear ships, showing that they had a tenfold excessive cancer. These things are not really shielded because they're small. They have to be small. They have to be light. So they're not like the big, huge ones that have an enormous concrete shielding. And in particular, what they do is they leak neutrons. So they don't have a big enough shielding to keep the neutrons in the reactor. And the neutrons come out and they turn the air into carbon-14 because, you know, you've got nitrogen-14 and you can turn the air into carbon-14, and carbon-14 gets incorporated into the body just like, you know, uranium. It's an internal radionuclide and it gives you cancer because, of course, everything in your body is made of carbon. And so there are lots and lots of bits of evidence that I've now dug out, and this is another paper I'll have to produce showing that the health effects of exposure to these small modular reactors are astonishingly high. Of course, the trouble is that they can say, look at, you know, this is Chris Busby, he wears a beret, he's a nutcase, you know, and doesn't matter what he publishes in the peer-reviewed literature, it's all a load of nonsense, and hurrah, let's go forward with nuclear, which is going to save us all. Anyway, all I can do in this is to remain, so long as they don't kill me, which is also possible, given that Stuart Smith died, is to remain, you know, a thorn in their flesh and to in the courts now draw attention to the fact that their risk model is utterly dishonestly constructed, and it's constructed in a way that is arbitrary and capricious.
Okay, that's Chris Busby. Dr. Chris Busby, speaking to me last week, mainly about depleted uranium and the use of that, but also they're looking at the whole kind of energy policy moving towards these snazzy sounding small modular reactors. He says, Martin, this is another disaster waiting to happen, and it's amazing that the Greens seem to be slowly but surely, because of their zero carbon ideas, getting behind this nuclear thing again.
It is, isn't it? I mean, it's extraordinary. I mean, the level of manipulation that's going on at the moment is absolutely extraordinary, isn't it? And, I mean, nuclear power doesn't make economic sense. I've got no nuclear physics qualifications whatsoever. But from an economic point of view, it doesn't make sense, because once you cost in the waste, it's just uneconomic. And when they tried to privatise the nuclear industry in Britain in the 1980s, I did a paper for the New Economics Foundation, and the City of London was going, we're foaming at the mouth about it, but the possibility of buying up British nuclear fuels. And then when they looked at the books and realised they were going to be held responsible for the waste, they just said, we're not touching this with a barge pole.
Well, you know,
because there's no money in it.
You know, he's a big fan of nuclear. Also, is our king. So let's have a listen to his. He doesn't make a big fuss about it, but if you have a look at his various pontifications, he's one of those people who's saying, well, actually, nuclear is the only option to have as our kind of base load. And of course, you know, he is also part of the World Economic Forum. He's, as we heard a few weeks ago, you know, he's going to have his coronation in May this year. And there's a lot of people saying, well, you know, you need to just decide to either butt out of politics and butt out of politics and opinion and be a little bit like your mum, and just let everyone else get on with it and be there in case it all goes wrong. But no, he's got to get his oar in. And here he is talking about his policies on energy and sustainable development and these various UN Sustainable Development Goals, which he himself wrote. Of course, he's going to say they're great, or he was involved in putting them together anyway, as he explains here.
This is the framework I've offered in the Terra Carta Roadmap, created by my Sustainable Markets Initiative, with nearly 100 specific actions for acceleration. Together, we are working to drive trillions of dollars in support of transition across 10 of the most emitting and polluting industries. They include energy, agriculture, transportation, health systems, and fashion. The reality of today's global supply chains means that industry transition will affect every country and every producer in the world. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind that the private sector is ready to play its part and to work with governments to find a way forward.
Yeah, interesting. He's saying actually the private sector is going to play its part, but it actually seems to be in the driving seat, really.
Well, that's right. I mean, I find it rather extraordinary that he's got such a detailed plan that we've all got to follow. I mean, he's a constitutional monarch, for God's sake. I mean, what is he supposed to come out with stuff like that? Obviously, well, he is, and there we are. But it's a rather, I mean, as you say, his mum wouldn't get involved in stuff like that. I mean, when she said after the 2008 crisis, did anybody predict this? And everybody, ooh, at the London School of Economics, that was just a legit question. But normally, why she was well liked is she didn't stick her oar in, as you say. But he clearly thinks that he's in a leadership role, and he needs to be told, no, you're not. You're a king.
Well, one of his mates was a guy called Jimmy Savile, and there was a fascinating documentary on tail end of last year. I think it may even have been a repeat, which I saw, and I'll put a link up to the full interview or the full audio of this documentary up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. Is Jimmy Savile by the people he abused and worked with, which was one of those documentaries that I've been kind of waiting for a long time after the death of Savile, which was just honest interviews of people who knew Savile in one way or another. Now, obviously, some of those people he had sexually abused and abused in other sorts of ways, but it was a fascinating insight into somebody, how somebody like this could be so close to someone like Prince Charles.
I did alert high-ranking police officers in the top four or five roles at Scotland Yard. And the feedback I got was that girls from troubled backgrounds like this making accusations against celebrities were in a no-win situation. So basically they didn't want to know.
In 2009, Surrey police detectives did interview Sir Jimmy Savile, now aged 82, about separate allegations by girls from Duncroft. But he would only agree to meet at his office in Stoke Mandeville Hospital.
What I've got here is really the only substantial police interview with James Wilson Savile, as it calls him here, in his entire life. And this was in 2009. All those years and all the things that he'd done that emerged later, he'd only ever really undergone one serious police interview. They put the point about the rumours, sexual relations with children, and Savile dismisses these allegations, saying, I've had five people make allegations that I did something because I take them to court, I sue them. They've made allegations, and not one of them wanted to finish up in court with me, so they all settled out of court. Savile sort of tries to explain away allegations against him by basically saying, people are just out to cause trouble, to blackmail me. And he says, that's why I've got this group of friends. So back referring to his old Friday morning club in Leeds, including quite a few senior policemen, and they deal with any problems. I give them my weirdo letters, pretty much telling these coppers from Surrey that he's got very influential police friends in Yorkshire, and these Surrey boys really ought to mind their own business. That's the Savile I remember, the arrogant, intimidating Savile, the litigious Savile, who, if you ever got anywhere close to him, threatened legal action or threatened his friends on high, would come down on you like a ton of bricks. That's Jimmy Savile I remember.
Sir Jimmy Savile, one of the most colourful figures in popular entertainment over the past 50 years, has died. He was 84.
He was paraded through the streets in that obnoxious casket.
I was horrified at the pomp and ceremony. It was, you know, gold coffin, streets lined with people. It was obscene.
His own charitable trust and colleagues from Stoke Mandeville Hospital, Leeds General Infirmary and Broadmoor
this selfless saint, Saint Jimmy, you know. That's not really who he is. He's a pervert. He's what he is.
Overnight, the sainted figure had become the embodiment of evil.
At Leeds General Infirmary, they're now mounting an investigation into who knew
what. When one 11-year-old with cancer screamed as he assaulted her, she was told by a nurse to be quiet.
All that it takes for evil to prevail is for good people to do nothing. And that happened time again.
The Metropolitan Police found that across more than 50 years, 450 people had been sexually abused by Jimmy Savile, 328 of them children. The unmasking of Savile changed the way people viewed celebrity. From now on, fame was no bar to guilt, and a host of high-profile cases followed.
My goodness gracious.
Today, one of the law firms central to the Jimmy Savile case said more complaints have been made against Rolf Harris since the verdict yesterday.
Freddie Starr groped her when she was 14 in Savile's BBC dressing room.
This isn't the first time he's been convicted of sexual offences. The former glam rock star, known to millions as Gary Glitter.
So there's an excerpt from that documentary. I put a full transcript and actually, yesterday, on my internet channels. I think that's the, not sure which channel, because I have to have a few going, otherwise YouTube just shut me down. So that's the documentary's called Jimmy Savile by the People He Abused and Worked With. Transmitted, I think, for the first time last year, but it may have been a little bit earlier. One of the things really concerning is the way that Savile managed to get along. But I think, Martin, in a way, the best thing that they're saying there is that after Savile, isn't the idea of that you're a famous person, a powerful person, a celebrity or whatever, is no barrier to people thinking that you may be.
I don't think I'd agree with that. I think, you know, yes, there was in the usual way, there was a huge mea culpa, you know, from the media and the establishment. And for a few months, you know, attitudes changed. But basically, we live in a society where if you need a job, you know, most places that you get a job from are going to respond to a phone call saying that you're not a nice person and maybe you should be sacked. There's so many different ways, landlords, there's so many ways that society influences people and suppresses complaints. And one thing that I thought was, to their great credit, the newspaper I don't usually agree with, the Daily Mail, the interesting thing to me was what they uncovered about this. If you go to the police with a complaint against a famous or powerful person, that will be directly sent on to MI5. Those local police will not act on it. And that's the real reason why nobody acted on complaints towards Jimmy Savile. And it's anybody in a position of power and authority. And the reason that's done is they say it's because, you know, to stop frivolous and malicious complaints and protect, you know, the rights of the people in authority. But actually, of course, what it does is it gives MI5 a huge archive of blackmail material against other powerful people in the establishment, and it even goes into the whip's offices in Parliament. The whip's offices are informed by MI5, and if the leader of the party, and particularly the Prime Minister, says, we want to get that MP who's making trouble, first, the way they do it is they look for those complaints, any complaints that person's
it's
had.
It's like, this is what they call the black book, isn't it?
I don't know, is that what it's
called?
That's
what it's called, the black. Yeah. There's a black book on all these, on every MP.
Keep squeaky clean, that's the only option from day one.
I agree with that, and I think a lot of this elite paedophilia is deliberately fostered by the intelligence service
as
a means of blackmail, as you say. The Kinkora Boys Home scandal, which when Ken Livingstone was first elected to Parliament as the MP for Brent, he's supposed to make a maiden speech, which is supposed to be, hello, my name's Ken Livingstone. It's supposed to be totally uncontroversial. But he got up, he made his maiden speech in the House of Commons about the Kinkora Boys Home scandal, because it was quite clear that MI5 were using the Kinkora Boys Home as a honey trap for loyalist paramilitaries who were brought in there, had sex with underage boys, and then they were blackmailable. And we know from evidence from some of those boys that were abused that they were then taken over to the mainland and similar things were going on. this is what the Epstein case is all about in the US.
Yeah.
Now, of course, you've also got general child abuse going on. You know, that is actually quite a lot more of that goes on than people like to realise. But of course, the elite child abuse is a deliberate policy of the state to encourage it and then either to cover it up or to use it as a means of blackmail. That's why that. That's why Savile was an Epstein figure. Yeah. Epstein took all of these people to his Lolita Island. And of course, it's all been videoed by, and then of course, it's in the hands of the intelligence services, in his case, Mossad.
We're going to have our break now, but we'll be coming back actually picking up on a similar subject, which is this idea of having a go at MPs, trying to destroy MPs. And our first item after the break, we'll be looking at Andrew Bridgen, because Dr. John Campbell, who's very popular, been extremely popular through the pandemic on YouTube, has had his video removed of his speech in the House of Commons. Now, this is a speech which is done under parliamentary privilege, and yet YouTube have said, no, you're not allowed to say that. So we're going to be hearing a little bit of that after the break.
Each other's needs to prefer. the storm. Into this house we're born. Into this world we're thrown. Like a dog without a bone, and packed we're out alone. Riders on the storm. There's a killer. Accustomed to do evil.
scatter them as the stubble that passeth away by the wind of the wilderness. This is thy lot, the portion of thy measures properly, saith the Lord, because thou hast forgotten me and trusted in falsehood. Therefore I will discover thy skirts upon thy face, that thy shame may appear. I have seen thine adulteries, thy gnawings, the lewdness of thy whoredom, and thine abominations in the hills and in the fields. Woe unto thee, O Jerusalem! Wilt thou not be made clean? When shall it once be? Here endeth the first lesson.
Riders on the storm. Riders on the storm. Into this house we're born. Into this world we're thrown. Like a dog without a bone and actor out of loan. Riders on the storm.
Riders on the Storm, 1971, from the Doors, a group you'll never hear on the BBC. For some strange reason, 7 or 8 years ago, they banned the Doors. So the Doors are no good. Actually, of course, they're rather wonderful. Then one of the most fascinating things about them is the connection of the lead singer Jim Morrison to the Admiral, who was in charge of the Sixth Fleet at the, I think it was the Six-Day War, either that or the Yom Kippur War. Anyway, it was the Six-Day War, and the Sixth Fleet being the U.S. Mediterranean. It was an admiral, Jim Morrison's father, and he was also involved, I think, Martin, if I'm right, in the Gulf of Tonkin too.
He was, which was the start of the Vietnam War. Jim Morrison was asked who his father was. He said, "I don't recognise my father."
He says he's dead. He said, "My father's dead." Yeah. But actually, of course, his dad would have been quite pleased to see how well he did. And becoming very famous, and there's some fascinating
being murdered by possibly the intelligence service,
almost certainly, yeah. And John Potash is the guy to check out if you want to look at the death of Jim Morrison and many of the other famous singers, people like John Lennon, etc., at the hands of the intelligence services. They like the idea of creating these kind of figures and then bumping them off and then trying to control the history, or the way that they're seen by history. Before that, we had Graham Kendrick and The Servant King. So, anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. And those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner, this is where you'll find us, and our listeners hopefully are thinking along those lines too, on the talkradio.org.uk stream and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, including the Apple Store, but please not Google. If you want a link to find download it from a non-Google place, just come along to our show page at thisweek.org.uk. One of the co-founders of the UK 9/11 Truth Movement is joining us, Ian Henshaw. Fascinating contribution about MI5 just now, and celebrities and MPs, and also, of course, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and me, Tony Gosling. So, well, as promised, we're not going to kick off with Scott Ritter, though he's got lots of interesting things to say about depleted uranium this week. I thought we'd start with this whole business of the experimental COVID vaccine injuries, which came up at Prime Minister's Questions, as well as has been censored by YouTube and championed, but now by Dr. John Campbell and by the Conservative MP Andrew Bridgen.
Sir Jeremy Wright, thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. My constituent, Jamie Scott, spent 4 weeks in a coma and remains seriously disabled as a result of a COVID vaccination. He and his family continue to believe that mass vaccination is the right policy, but it must also surely be right to ensure that that tiny minority who are seriously injured as a result are properly compensated. In the absence of court cases, it's in no one's interests to litigate. The current limit on compensation is £120,000, even for very serious and lifelong injury, and anyone who is disabled by less than 60% gets nothing at all. That cannot be right. Will my right honourable friend look urgently at changing it?
Mr. Speaker, it is important to start by recognising the importance of vaccines in protecting us all, and not least the fantastic rollout of the COVID vaccines across the UK. But I am very sorry to hear about the case that my right honourable friend raises. In the extremely rare case of a potential injury from a vaccine covered by the scheme, a one-off payment can be awarded. This is not designed to be a compensation scheme, and it does not prevent the injured person in pursuing a legal compensation claim with the vaccine manufacturer. We are taking steps to reform vaccine damage payment schemes by modernising the operations and providing more timely outcomes. But of course, I'll be happy to talk to the Honourable Gentleman further about it.
Yeah, well, the first thing to say there is pointed out by TechOp Dave here, is that there is a scheme that where the government has to pay compensation for any injuries due to the vaccines, Martin, not the vaccine company. So quite why Rishi Sunak is saying that. And also, as part of that question, it's quite clear they're trying to keep this all out of the courts and they're just offering people compensation, except if you're only 50% disabled by one of these jabs, you get nothing at all.
Well, they were given immunity from prosecution, or, you know, from compensation damages, weren't they, at the very beginning?
Yeah.
Because, in other words, normally a vaccine like this would take years to come to development, they'd have to have tested it on
your
animals
Pfizer's
and all the rest of it.
And your Moderna's were saying, well, look, this is going to be really expensive to do this. So, you know, if anything goes wrong, we need you to be a backstop for us, basically to get the government and the Department for Health to be our insurance policy.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I mean, there's obviously a huge slew of issues here.
It's a bit like the banking bailout, isn't it? You know, where we want to actually, well, if it all goes wrong, we want you to pick up the bill. Well, of course, it did all go wrong. In fact, in many ways, there's lots of people, as we're about to hear from Andrew Bridgen, who did get injured by this experimental mRNA vaccine.
Yes, and I think that asking legitimate questions about it is legitimate. Although, of course, most people on the planet have not been given mRNA vaccines. Nobody in China has had one. Nobody in Russia has had one. And that's because they developed their own under public sector auspices.
So it amazes me that these companies can be in the situation where they can make massive profits, billions and billions of pounds out of these jabs. And yet, if anything goes wrong, we pick up the bill. Isn't it just like 2008?
Well, it is. Of course it is. And that's why in China, for example, the Sinopharm vaccine was developed by the public sector. In Cuba, they developed four different non-mRNA vaccines for COVID under public sector auspices.
And one of the reasons I think this is such an important story this week is the banning by YouTube of Dr. John Campbell's video of Andrew Bridgen's speech this week. It was up there and probably got millions of views. I'm not sure how many views it did get on YouTube before YouTube decided to take it down. And I'll let Dr. John Campbell introduce the topic himself. He's somebody who's been, he's become one of the go-to places right the way through the pandemic. And he is now somebody who's coming round to the view that these COVID jabs are dangerous and people need to, and the whole thing needs to be investigated as part of a public inquiry. You know, obviously the official government inquiry isn't looking into any of this, but we, journalists and ordinary individuals, certainly are.
Well, a warm welcome to today's talk, Friday the 17th of March. Now, today in the British Parliament, Mr. Andrew Bridgen gave an incredibly well-thought-out, well-researched speech because he's concerned about potential adverse events following COVID vaccination. Now, as soon as he started to speak, everyone from the Houses of Parliament left. It was like a walkout protest. It's just a national disgrace. There was two Conservative MPs left apart from Mr. Bridgen. There was three on the front bench who had to be there. There was no one from Labour, no one from the Liberal Democrats, zero MPs from the Scottish Nationalists. Just a complete disgrace. I can only assume they're under orders not to attend because it really was quite incredible. And you can just see the empty benches for yourself. Anyway, I'm going to play it. It takes about 10, 15 minutes. Obviously, Mr. Bridgen is privileged and can say things I'm not allowed to say. So let's give him our attention now because it is a remarkably good speech. And it does cover a lot of the points that we have talked about ourselves recently on this channel. So over to Mr. Bridgen now.
Mr. Deputy Speaker, on the 13th of December last year, I was kindly granted an adjournment debate on the potential harms that emergency use experimental mRNA COVID-19 vaccines cause. It's fair to say that night my life changed. During that speech, in the evidence data I presented to the House, which no one has effectively rebutted, I highlighted to the Minister the scale of harms that the experimental vaccines have caused and continue to cause. In giving that speech to an almost empty chamber on this most important of issues, quite literally life and death, two things happened to me immediately. First, I was cancelled by the mainstream media, despite sending a data sheet in the wake of the debate, scientifically evidencing every point that I made. Not one media organisation wanted to talk about the issue of serious harms or death occurring as a result of the mRNA vaccines. Mr. Deputy Speaker, I fully expect that they will show the same level of disinterest in today's debate. It's what we've come to expect from a media more interested in navel-gazing at the pontifications of Britain's foremost football pundit instead of the horror and tragedy of excess deaths taking place before their very eyes. Some 3 months on from that speech, and a scattering of reports are now appearing in the mainstream media, sadly, the number of people affected in the UK and across the world cannot be ignored or hidden indefinitely.
Well, now, thank you.
I will on that point.
Will you accept that there's a bit of a light on the horizon in that this week alone, the Daily Express has had 4 full pages on this subject?
I thank my right honourable friend. He's a stalwart supporter for those who've been vaccine harmed, and I do hope that we can see some light at the end of the tunnel, and hopefully this speech today will bring more light into the darkness. In truth, I care little about being cancelled by the media because in the wake of that speech, something far more important has happened. I was contacted by thousands of people offering their support and received many hundreds and hundreds of emails from all over the globe recounting to me their own stories of the harms caused in the wake of their or their loved ones' COVID vaccination. I've been contacted by parents in my own and surrounding constituencies thanking me for questioning why we're giving these experimental vaccinations to healthy children and young people that patently do not need them and gain no protection from them. I was contacted by far too many relatives who had lost loved ones suddenly after having the Moderna, Pfizer or AstraZeneca experimental gene therapy treatments shot into their arms. Many of them asked in their emails why this vitally important issue was not being taken more seriously by many of my honourable and right honourable colleagues. That, Mr. Deputy Speaker, is a question for my colleagues to answer. A lot more questioned why, as evidence continues to emerge almost on a daily basis, the Fourth Estate was so remiss in its coverage. That, Mr. Deputy Speaker, is a question for the lobby to answer. But every one of those who contacted me asked me to keep up the fight, to continue to raise awareness of vaccine harms and vaccine deaths. Mr. Deputy Speaker, that is the question I am here to answer today. So the government's own data shows that in healthy adults aged 50 to 59, it was necessary to give 256,400 booster jabs to to prevent just one severe hospitalisation, putting 321 people into hospital with a serious side effect from the booster, which includes, obviously, risk of death. For 40 to 49-year-olds, that number increases to 932,500 who need to be boosted to keep one COVID patient out of ITU, putting potentially 1,165 people into hospital with serious harms, death or disability. And for the healthy 30 to 39-year-olds, no one knows the answer to the number needed to be boosted to prevent a serious hospitalisation, because the government's own data says that there's never been such a case of this age group being put into intensive care due to the current variant of COVID-19. But many, indeed on average, one in 800 of them, of this group that's been boosted, will have died or been disabled or seriously harmed by the booster itself. Let me focus now on the most vulnerable group for which the government data is available. The over 70s, with comorbidities, the most vulnerable group in our society. According to the government's own data, it would be necessary to administer 800 vaccine boosters to prevent just one hospitalisation for a patient over the age of 70 in this highest risk group. Mr. Deputy Speaker, that means that all the most vulnerable group in our society are doing, by being boosted, is swapping one risk from COVID of hospitalisation for exactly the same risk from the booster itself. But of course, in the process, Big Pharma is making huge profits.
So that's an excerpt from Andrew Bridgen's speech. I'll put the full version of that up on our show page at thisweekuncensored.org.uk. Always disgusted to see these major platforms, including, of course, the mainstream legacy media, censoring Andrew Bridgen. I mean, he's coming out with some interesting facts there, Martin. One of them is that by the doctor's calculation, there's something like 1,165 casualties, people who are being hospitalised because of having the vaccine, for every one person who will go to hospital because they've caught COVID within one age gap. I mean, it's getting mad. It's becoming obsessive. And the idea that, I mean, let's just leave the jab number one and jab number two aside. He's specifically talking here about the boosters. And the boosters, of course, are taking place at a time where COVID, the Omicron variant, is far less dangerous. In fact, some people have called it a gift from God, because it helps you actually get immunity to COVID.
Well, I was a bit, I mean, it's all, you know, legit stuff. He did say that AstraZeneca was an mRNA vaccine, and I was under the impression that AstraZeneca's were not an mRNA vaccine. So I'm not quite sure.
What about
that.
This principle, though, about one? I think it was the 50 to 60 age group he was talking about. 1,165 casualties going to hospital after having a booster jab for every one person with Omicron COVID that might go to hospital, to prevent one person going to hospital. It just seems like the prevention, the cure is worse than the disease by 1,165 times.
These figures, if true, are absolutely totally devastating. And I speak as somebody who's on open mind. I'm not on particularly one side or the other, although I had some interesting experiences concerning COVID, which we might get onto later. But what strikes me is that the supporters of the system will have produced a briefing paper which they'll have given to journalists, and that briefing paper will say, "Don't go near this guy. He's full of crap. He's a loony."
The black book, isn't it? Really,
yeah.
Again,
and so what we really would need, you know, to make a definitive judgment, is that briefing statement. And funnily enough, they're very reluctant to give out anything like
people who believe
in freedom of information.
Well, you know what he says? He says he actually put out his own briefing statement with the speech he gave back in.
Tony, as a journalist, I would like to see what his opposition is saying. I'd like to see here both sides of
a
the story.
A lot of this is done behind the scenes, isn't
well,
it?
Well, yeah.
So the journalists are lobbied to not say anything.
Exactly, and not say that they've been told not to say anything either. That's the difference. I mean, the frightening thing here in the West, compared to what it used to be like in the Soviet Union, is that in the Soviet Union, journalists would say to you, "Of course, we admit we're censored." In the West, they won't admit that. I don't know if they're self-deluded or they're just lying and laughing at you behind their lies, but I've never heard a Western mainstream journalist admit that they are censored.
Well, there was, I can't try and remember his name. And it was a book which was translated into English. Maybe you can help me out here, Martin. It was someone who was, I think he was a German journalist. He was saying that.
Yeah, I remember the one.
He was saying that actually, look, the CIA is totally running
the whole thing.
The intelligence services are keeping an eye on everything we say, and everyone that starts to tell the truth on certain subjects, very much like we were told that the Soviet Union operated, is going to be eased out of their job.
Well, that's right.
He died of a heart attack, didn't he?
Well, I think it was, did he die recently?
Yeah,
he's dead. Yeah. Well, I think it's Ufkel or something like that. I can't remember his exact name.
Ufkoti, I think.
That's right. Yes, and of course they've admitted that Angela. We were talking about this earlier. Angela Merkel's phone, when she was Chancellor of Germany, was routinely bugged by the CIA and MI6.
And given that she would have the most security, everybody else is as well.
Yeah, and of course, the thing about the modern computer surveillance is, unlike the Stasi in East Germany, where they had to actually record it all and then replay it and then work out what people were saying to each other, the computers can now go through everything and they can pick out the stuff they want. So that's why mass surveillance has become so easy. Because of the technology has changed, that it makes it so easy for the state or other non-state actors to, you know, to basically survey the population and therefore to, you know, pass information back to the deep state so they can do what they want.
Udo Ulfkotte, I'll spell that for you. That's UdoUlfkotte. Website is ulfkotte.de. Was a German journalist and conspiracy theorist, says Wikipedia.
Oh, we know what that means.
That must be Wikipedia, mustn't it? Who maintained that journalists and leading newspapers published material that had been fed to them or bought by the Central Intelligence Agency and other Western intelligence and propaganda agencies. Several media outlets rejected, funnily enough, his claims, says Wikipedia, but of course that's him. And in fact, there is a book out there that's been translated into English by him explaining how it all works. So, of course, those newspaper empires, the ones that also sit down there at the Bilderberg conferences and don't tell anybody that the conference is even taking place and keep all their wealth squirreled away in tax havens, they say that, this never happens. This never takes place, Ian.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking how you were saying earlier about how money, you know, how powerful money is. Because the one thing that also beyond that money does is it buys newspapers. I mean, capitalism is about ownership. And I mean, I remember the Daily Mirror. The Daily Mirror opposed the invasion of Iraq. About the same time, it was taken over by an American New York financial setup. And they said, oh, of course, we're not going to have any influence whatsoever on the editorial contents of this newspaper. That would be totally undemocratic. Within 2 years, the editor had been sacked, a certain Piers Morgan, not everybody's cup of tea, but at that point he was leading a very brave campaign against the invasion of Iraq. He was sacked, the newspaper had been taken over by New York, and that's the easiest way. You don't have to send in people with machine guns, you just go to the bank and get a loan and buy it, and then you can get rid of anybody you want.
Udo Ulfkotte was found dead of a sudden heart attack in January 2017, Martin.
Well, that's potentially suspicious, isn't it?
At the time, he was not known, his family say, to have been suffering from any major health issues.
Well, I mean, the implication of that is obvious.
Yeah, heart attacks. This is a way to possibly kill people, isn't it? Yeah. We've already heard about a few weeks ago about the hacker who was killed when he was about to expose the ability of the National Security Agency to hack pacemakers and kill people like that.
Well, I mean, basically, the Western deep state has been murdering people for years. I mean,
this is what Michael Hudson was saying earlier, isn't it?
Tucker Carlson.
Assassinate your opponents.
I mean, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was, on the social media quite not that long ago saying, because Tucker Carlson said, well, it's now obvious that Robert Kennedy was murdered by the state.
Even Newsnight admitted that, actually, yes. Between the lines.
That's right. So, in other words, the Russians are, you know, being beaten over the head for not being democratic by the United States. But you've had two. I mean, Robert Kennedy was going to probably be president before he was murdered. Because he just won the Democratic
primary. And he was going to avenge his brother's death by investigating the CIA.
That's right. And of course, and Martin Luther King, there's been a court case, a civil court case in Tennessee, which concluded that he was definitely murdered by the state.
Both of you probably know a guy called Paul Barbara. He managed to get the book by Udo Ofcotti translated into English, and it's available, published in October 2019, 2 years after he was found dead. Prostitutes embedded in the pay of the CIA, a confession from the profession. So that book, I'll put a link to that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk too. But I think it's time now to go and have a look at what's been going on. And it's absolutely extraordinary to see all this depleted uranium stories, Martin, coming up on the news. The threat is that Putin and Xi and various other leaders around the world are rather concerned that the Ukrainians may be following in the footsteps of NATO in Iraq and in Bosnia to use depleted uranium. Now, can you say something about the implications of this and your take on it before we hear from Scott Ritter?
Well, what's extraordinary is that the Baroness somebody in Britain said, we are definitely going to be supplying depleted uranium shells to help the Ukrainians resist Russian aggression, blah, blah, blah. I mean, the fact is, it's quite not clear that they're going to be able to get this weaponry in there because, of course, the supply lines of the Ukrainian army are being constantly bombarded by the Russians.
I mean, you would normally associate uranium with radiation, but this isn't like an atomic weapon, is it?
No, the problem with this stuff is it's actually relatively harmless until it's exploded in a shell, in which case it then gets turned into powder, and then of course it can get access to, people can breathe it in, they can get cuts, can get it. If it's actually depleted uranium as it is, it's not actually from a reactor or something. I was reading today, and of course what it's used for is very good for knocking out tanks, which is why they used it in Iraq and in
It hardens things, doesn't it? It makes things super hard.
The Russians have said that they will take this as a step up of the war, and they will respond to it accordingly.
Yes, I don't think they're going to go nuclear. I mean, it's the problem with it is it contaminates the area where it's been used for possibly generations.
I asked Dr. Chris Busby last week about whether it was possible that maybe the Russians were using this depleted uranium, which he believes is the reason for the increase of uranium in the atmosphere here, as supplied by Freedom of Information requests to Burfield and Aldermaston, who do samples all the time. And you look at the samples, you can see in March and April 2022, just after the Ukraine war started, suddenly there's a massive spike in the amounts of uranium in the atmosphere. And he's saying, you know, could it just simply be because uranium is being chucked into the atmosphere because it's being used in Ukraine? But anyway, let's have a listen to Scott Ritter's take on all this now, and his weekly show he does with Judge Neapolitano now.
Look, depleted uranium rounds, very dense, and when you turn them into a penetrating rod and you put them in a sabot, they become really good anti-tank round. And we use them in our M1 Abrams. The British use them in their Challenger 2 tanks. I think the Germans may have one time used them in their Leopard tanks. The Russians, the Soviets used to have them too, because they're very good tank killers. But the Russians, again, people are going to go, Scott, you keep talking like the Russians are the good guys. Well, on this one, they are. Because around 2000, the Russians look around, they said, we see what's happened when the NATO used 30,000 depleted uranium rounds in Kosovo, high levels of leukemia. People are starting to get cancer because they've been exposed to the depleted uranium. We see what happened in Iraq, where kids are deformed, thousands of kids are deformed. So the Russians banned depleted uranium. They said, we will no longer make depleted uranium rounds because we understand it is poison to our troops, to the civilians, to the soil. And they're 100% correct. The United States and Great Britain, they suppress this data and they say there's nothing wrong with this. Now, what the Russians said is, you guys can have it. Don't introduce it in Ukraine. We don't want that poison on Slavic soil. We don't want that poison infecting our troops, the Ukrainian people, anybody. Keep it out of here. And now what the British have done with their 14, I think they've upped it to 28 Challenger 2 tanks, is they said they're coming in equipped with depleted uranium anti-tank rounds. Is this going to be a game changer on the battlefield? No, all it means is that the poor Ukrainian soldiers who are in a tank now with depleted uranium rounds are going to die because as soon as those 28 tanks show up, the Russians will kill all 28 of them and all the depleted uranium rounds in there will burn up with the tank. One or two may be fired, but that's it. But It's a total disrespect for the Russians, a total disregard for, you know, what they've said is an environmental issue. And the Russians are just putting the market down. Is Putin going to escalate nuclear? No. He's just saying, we're angry here, and there will be ramifications, because if they do fire those rounds and civilians become infected, Russia will have a case to say, it's on you guys. You're the one who brought that poison into this conflict.
Are you telling me that under President Clinton, the United States used these weapons in Bosnia, knowing that it would cause leukemia, even to the people they were trying to defend?
Absolutely, because in the Gulf War, this issue was raised. In the Gulf War, we had force-on-force issues where M1 Abrams fired depleted uranium rains into an M1 Abrams with depleted uranium armor. And when those hit, you know, it vaporized, it got into the bloodstream of our veterans, and our veterans are very sick, and they pass it on to their wives, and they have deformed children. This is fact. Now, the VA isn't allowed to say this, because the United States, the second we say that depleted uranium is a poison, infects people, then we're in trouble for continuing to use it. So we've been suppressing this data forever, but we use it in Bosnia knowing this. But then we turned around and use it in Fallujah in 2004, and we have, this is under George W. Bush, and we have condemned tens of thousands of Iraqi children to deaths where, I mean, they're born horrifically deformed. Their mothers get cancer. The fathers get cancer. People get cancer. We know this is the case, but we don't want to talk about it because it's a matter of money. It's cheaper to make this round than it is to use tungsten, a tungsten penetrator.
Is the U.S. supplying these leukemia-causing rounds to the Ukrainians, or is it just the Brits?
So far, just the Brits. United States, the Pentagon has come out and said that we will not be providing depleted uranium rounds now that the Brits have broken this, you have people in the Pentagon saying, well, we're going to reconsider this now. Because it's not just the M1A1 Abrams tank that uses this. DU rounds, depleted uranium rounds, can be used on the 25-millimeter Bushmasters. That'll be on the Stryker vehicles, on the Bradleys. And so, you know, there's a lot of DU that can be out there. And if we start providing it, we are going to be poisoning Ukraine. There's no doubt about it.
Scott Ritter there talking to Judge Neapolitano. Martin, looks like the Brits are in the front line again here.
Well, I mean, isn't it extraordinary that the British have pushed themselves forward to supply depleted uranium weaponry to the Ukrainians when even the Americans are blanching at this may be an escalation which we can't control? I don't suppose that the Russians will you know, it makes it less likely that there's going to be any negotiated solution.
I mean, when we started
if that's your attitude, we're not talking to you, we're just going to finish this.
When we started doing this program way back in, whenever it was, 2008, we had a guest on here quite regularly in the first couple years, a lovely lady called Joanne Baker. She wrote and co-wrote a book with a couple of Iraqis, Uranium in Iraq, The Poisonous Legacy of the Iraq Wars. And she's she was based here in Bristol, one of the only people in the world to be really speaking out about this.
Well, what's underlying all of this is the United States is an ocean away, and they're not really. I mean, they're making loads of the military industrial complex in the US is making a huge packet out of all of this, and they don't really care the consequences of what they do. They're potentially going to drive us into a nuclear war, and so therefore just killing a few children with leukemia and DU is just a roadkill as far as they're concerned, isn't it?
All sorts of health. I mean, basically the book is about the massive changes in the health of Iraqis as a result of the use of depleted uranium there.
Well, it's a war crime, isn't it? It's as simple as that.
Also interesting that the idea is that if you look at the way the battle lines are going in Ukraine, if there is a big tank battle, that territory is the territory that NATO wants to claim for Ukraine, and yet apparently they're going to be littering it with radiation.
That's because they don't care what happens to the Ukraine. The policy is to try and destroy Russia and China, and what happens to the Ukraine is of no real interest to the people behind all of this.
And Scott Ritter's also saying that, well, you can use a tungsten, because tungsten's got a much higher, I think it's a higher melting point or something than any other metal, but it's a bit expensive. This DU is actually radioactive waste, and it's much, much cheaper.
That's right, and therefore more profitable for the privately owned arms companies that are behind the war in Ukraine.
I suppose,
of course, the Russians, you know, they've got a nationalised arms industry effectively, and if they decide they're going to use tungsten, they'll use tungsten. It may cost more, but it's the right way to go, isn't it? Do it properly.
Yeah, so any other implications for this? Because it just seems to me that this is, you know, every step and every turn with the Ukraine war, and this time with President Xi over in Moscow at 2, the West is losing the propaganda war. It's kind of banked on winning the propaganda war, making Zelensky out to be a superhero, Putin out to be a demon, and yet actually what's happening is the opposite.
Well, I think it depends where you are. I think the propaganda works within the Western bubble, where most people in Britain are unaware that the Americans blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, for example. They just don't know it happened. But, of course, in places like South Africa and Mexico, I mentioned earlier, they're already banging on about it. That's the real world outside the Western bubble.
Anyway, again, Al Jazeera report now from the meeting between President Xi of China and Vladimir Putin of Russia, where they're actually being forced closer together than ever by this Ukraine war and by the attitude of the NATO countries in the West.
They say it's an alliance without limits. China and Russia are expanding trade and diplomatic cooperation. The two countries insist their relations are far from being a military and political alliance. But Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin share a growing concern of what they perceive to be an American dominance across the globe. For the Chinese leader, who secured an unprecedented third term earlier this month, this trip could be the moment to establish his country as an international peacemaker.
We shall always respect and abide by the UN Charter. We will always promote peace and also promote negotiation and discussion. Our stance is always based on fairness and justice. We will always be on the side of peace. We are always on the side of dialogue. We are always on the side of historic fairness and justice.
But ending war in Ukraine may not be an easy task. China is yet to elaborate on its 12-point peace plan. Beijing has called on Russia and Ukraine to address their security concerns without mentioning Russian troops withdrawal, a key demand for Kyiv. The US has dismissed the peace plan as a stalling tactic. In the meantime, Western nations are stepping up military assistance to Ukraine.
Today we learned that the Minister of Defence of the UK declared he would supply tanks to the Ukraine and also uranium-enriched weapons to Ukraine. I think that the West will now fight Russia to the last Ukrainian.
Facing growing international isolation, Vladimir Putin is turning to President Xi Jinping, an alliance largely shaped following Russian invasion of Ukraine last year. After the EU imposed a ban on Russian energy imports, China stepped in, buying large quantities of cheap Russian oil, providing cash-strapped Moscow with much-needed revenue. The US considers China the biggest threat to its national security and fears Beijing could be exploiting Russia's embattled standing to expand its geopolitical influence. Hashim Al-Barra, Al Jazeera.
Martin?
Well, what's very interesting this last week, and they've hardly again reported in the Western media, is that the Saudis and the Iranians have reopened diplomatic relations with each other, which is exactly what Soleimani was going to do when he was assassinated by Trump. He was on his way to Riyadh to talk to the Saudis. But the Saudis and the Iranians have reopened diplomatic relations, and they signed the deal with each other to reopen diplomatic relations in Beijing. And of course, this is leading to the possibility of the resolution of the war in Yemen. Meanwhile, we're supplying depleted uranium to continue and escalate the war in the Ukraine. People in the developing world, people like Mexico and South Africa and Brazil, they can see who the warmongers are.
Well,
and who the
it's interesting, isn't it? Because the Al Jazeera guy there is talking about growing international isolation of Russia. Well, I don't see that, actually.
No, I don't see it either.
I mean, it's obviously coming
it's
from
it's a fantasy.
A partisan point of view, really.
Yes, but I mean, don't forget that the Al Jazeera is controlled by the government in Qatar, and they've got their own interests. So, you know, and in any case, if you're having a debate in an international, you know, you have to kind of pretend that you go along with what people are saying in order to get into a dialogue with them. The rest of the world has made up its mind about the Nord Stream 2 pipeline bombing. They've made their mind up about it. The Mexican president brought it up in his major speech this week in the center of Mexico to a huge rally, which was a very much a nationalist rally against the US policy in Mexico in relation to all sorts of things. But also it's becoming clear to the developing world that the West created the war in the Ukraine and that they are the problem. I don't think Rishi Sunak or Keir Starmer are aware of, you know, if they are aware, they're totally unprepared for the consequences of all this. Indians, of course, where Rishi Sunak's family originally came from, they've massively increased their buying of Russian oil and gas. And they're not, no way, Jose, are they joining in any kind of sanctions on Russia. And therefore, of course, the Russians and are now in a position to help mediate discussions between Russia and between China and India. Yeah. So this is what's beginning to happen, is the rest of the world is beginning to form an alliance against the Western capitalist powers. And in other words, we are going to lose this, and we're going to deserve to lose it because we started.
Well, we also seem to be about to lose the fight for the international financial system at the same time. Zelensky this week has been telling Europe to give more weapons and add sanctions on Russia. The Ukrainian leader says there cannot be even a slight hint in delay when it comes to new sanctions. Zelensky said in a virtual address to EU leaders, they must provide longer range weapons and Western made fighter jets. He thanked Slovakia and Poland for providing the MiG-29 planes, but said Kiev needs much more modern aircraft.
That's really ironic, because Slovakia, of course, seceded from Czechoslovakia. You know, they said, no, we want to go independent. And Czechoslovakia said, yeah, you know, if you want to go independent. What a contrast to Ukraine, where East Ukraine wanted to go independent. So, you know, it's you have to laugh. Really,
the hypocrisy,
don't you?
Of it always beyond belief, isn't it?
Ian, what's your take on the whole Ukraine war business? Because, I mean, I know you and I first got to know each other over criticising the whole 9/11 attacks narrative. And that's a long time ago now, but it's, you know, it's kind of chugged down the pipeline. I think most of the post 9/11 influence we thought was in the Middle East, and many of the wars which started were, for whatever reason, anti-Islamic laws, Americans invading Islamic countries like Afghanistan, Iraq, etc. were largely Islamic countries. But this is a bit different, isn't it? Do you think what's going on in Ukraine relates to the whole post 9/11 fallout?
No, I think it's sort of the same in that they create a false narrative and then they say, oh, well, it's sort of bait and switch. They create the false narrative and then they say later, once that's established, oh, and that unfortunately means we've got to go to war. Now, if you take 9/11, I personally, although I campaign very much against the wars and, you know, I would, if I'd thought that the 9/11 story was true, then I might have supported those wars. You know, they had a sort of argument. You know, maybe bin Laden could have got hold of some nuclear weapons and set them off in Europe. You know, so I think the big mistake that anti-war people make in the West here is they don't challenge the basic narrative. They accept the basic narrative. Putin's an aggressor. We're under threat from Osama bin Laden. They accept that basic narrative. And once you do accept that basic narrative, then you're in trouble, because the whole weight of the media is going to be pushing behind what appears to be quite a logical extension of that. And really what we have to say, but over 9/11, we have to say, well, actually, this narrative can't be right. The people who were supposed to have flown those planes could not fly planes in that way. And here's the evidence, and there was plenty of evidence for that. And in the case of Ukraine, we have to say, I would say, you know, as a peacemaker, I hope for it as a peacemaker, we have to say, it didn't start when Putin invaded East Ukraine. It started when West Ukraine tore up the Minsk Accords, which would have settled the problem in a perfectly normal and regular way. Lots of precedent for it. Separate the two parts of Ukraine, put one technically under the other, but give them as much freedom as they want, just like Scotland has in Britain nowadays. That's all the Minsk Accords were saying, and they were solemnly signed by Russia. Not by Russia, because Russia wasn't a party
It was the Ukrainian central government signed the deal with the rebels.
France and Germany, wasn't it?
No, France, Germany, and Russia were guarantors.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And so it was an internal Ukrainian agreement.
And what went wrong was that Minsk Accords were torn up within weeks by the West Ukrainian, the coup regime, as it was in West Ukraine, and then France and Germany did nothing about it. So what they should have done is to have said to Ukraine, West Ukraine, if you ever want to join NATO, if you ever want to join the EU, if you even want to trade with us, you will sign these accords. Otherwise, there's going to be a ghastly war, which, of course, is exactly what's happened.
Amazing. Anyway, we're going to be talking a little bit more about the press's role in all of this after we've heard from Professor Jeffrey Sachs, who was interviewed this week, talking about, well, he's explaining his view that actually that the war in Ukraine is nothing to do with Ukraine. It's really about China.
Professor, one-third, maybe a little less, of Ukraine territory is occupied by Russia. So insisting on negotiations right now means that Putin is winning.
Well, I already gave my advice many times to the Ukrainian people and government, which is don't get caught in a proxy war between the U.S. and Russia, because your country will be destroyed. And that is the tragedy. I said to the Ukrainians, look at Afghanistan. Is that what you want to look at? 15 years of occupation and continued destruction, 20 years basically from the time of the U.S. invasion. Don't do it. I told them all my life the U.S. has been, quote, helping, in quotation marks, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Iraq, Syria, Libya. What kind of help? This ends up destroying the country. In the U.S., starting in 1992, the dominant group in American security policy came to believe that the U.S. is the world's only superpower. So the whole mindset in the U.S. East Coast elite is the U.S. runs the world and should run the world.
Don't you think that Ukrainians, they don't have the right to choose their own future?
The Ukrainians have the right to choose their own economic future, their own political future, but not their own military future. Because choosing their own military future, for example, Ukraine saying, our future is that the U.S. has military bases in Ukraine, is not a choice that Ukraine can make by itself. That's a threat to Russia. I would advise strongly the Mexican government, for example, do not make a military alliance with China. That's not your choice. That would be a threat. By the way, if Mexico one day said, we listened to the U.S., they said we can do anything we want, we're a free people, we choose China as our partner, I would predict that the U.S. invasion of Mexico would start within about a minute. I strongly advise the Mexican government not to make a military alliance with China.
Professor, how can we understand the relatively hawkish position of the European allies?
I'm really disappointed in European leaders right now, because I know privately they have all sorts of views that they are not explaining to their public. I've spoken to the heads of government in Europe where they've said to me, for example, NATO enlargement, very bad idea. In fact, Scholz went to Russia in January, February 2022 and said to Putin, as long as I'm chancellor, NATO's not expanding. And Putin looked at him and said, yeah, how long are you going to be chancellor? I need the United States as my counterpart, not you. And he told the truth. This is a U.S. alliance. It's not a German alliance. And the U.S. is absolutely on the hardline side. The real mindset now of the U.S. leadership is we have two enemies that threaten our unipolar world. One is minor. That's Russia. We'll weaken them. We'll have the war for a while. We'll wear them down. But that's a second-rate regional power. They forget about 1,600 nuclear weapons. They forget about 11 time zones. They forget about some of the largest resource deposits in the world. They forget about the talents of the Russian people. All of that. No, Russia, but we'll weaken them. We'll weaken them. The one that's terrifying them is China. They don't quite know what to do. So right now, one of the arguments is we need to be tough in Ukraine to show China we mean business. If we back down now, what's China going to do over Taiwan? Honestly, Ukraine isn't even the center of attention. Ukraine thinks, oh, this is a war about us. No. First, it's a war to weaken Russia, in which Ukraine is stuck losing hundreds of thousands of people and cities. It's horrible. But it's not even about Ukraine in the twisted mindset of some of these elites. It's about China.
So, like Jeffrey Sachs versus Goldman Sachs in some mad world. But, Martin, what do you make of that? He's really, I think he's slowly and very carefully manoeuvring us to understand that this is what's going on in the elite psychos in the United States' point of view. Is they really want to have to get rid of China eventually, but they know they need to get Russia out of the way first.
Well, I think full marks to Jeffrey Sachs. He has actually, he has spoken out with absolute integrity in the last few years about all of these things. And of course, I remember him from the 1990s when I used to work in Eastern Europe and I visited Russia. And he was actually the author of the Gaidar Plan, which was the crash shock and awe.
The oligarchs were riding to power. That's right. And
at the time, he was him and Anders Aslund, who's a Swedish economist, were our bête noirs. These are the enemy.
Mm, absolutely.
But because he's so well connected at the top of the U.S. elite, he knows what they think because he knows them all.
Maybe he's a sort of Gore Vidal figure,
Well, I mean,
whistleblower from within the elite.
That's right. Unlike Gore Vidal, he's got real. Gore Vidal is basically a novelist. I mean, he's an economist and he's regarded as a technocrat.
Yeah.
But of course, what's really interesting, I don't want to go down the wormhole, but he's the one who's saying, look, it looks to me, and he was put in charge by the Lancet of looking into the origins of COVID-19, and he's saying it came from a US laboratory. That's the evidence that I've got. And of course that fits in with what he's saying about getting rid of China. Because as Ron Unz has pointed out on his website, it looks as if there was a deliberate attempt to wreck the Chinese economy using COVID-19 by the US deep state, which has led to millions of deaths.
Fascinating.
Including deaths from vaccines.
And we will eventually get round to looking at the Central Intelligence Agency and Vietnam, Vietnam Colonel John Stockwell. But before we do that, let's just have a look at Pakistan and Israel, because all sorts of things have been going on in those other countries too, in the sort of military geopolitics of everything. And Imran Khan has been issuing this plot, he says, on YouTube, telling everyone that there is some sort of plot to imprison or kill him. And he seems to be right. What's just the basics of what happened in Pakistan is the CIA turned up with loads of money and bribed a whole load of MPs to impeach him. And even though his prime minister, he's now been booted out. So the Americans just control Pakistan. But of course, they go on and on about, oh, it's a sovereign country. They've just decided to impeach their prime minister. No, you CIA have done it. And we all know. Anyone that knows, knows anyway. So let's have a listen to a short report on what's been going on in Pakistan with Imran Khan.
Former Prime Minister Imran Khan will be allowed to hold a rally, authorities have ruled. The decision comes after his party, Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, gave assurances including the rally would be peaceful. But Khan took to a YouTube live address to make serious allegations. He said there was a plan underway to target him. The former cricket star turned leader has been outspoken against the Pakistani military's involvement in politics, as well as the traditional governing parties.
I am warning all of you, if I am imprisoned or killed, then you have to stand and never accept it as a defeat, but you have to fight till the last ball. Again, I am telling you, they're going to eliminate me sooner or later so that they can get rid of me and the movement we started against these thieves who have looted this country for decades.
Khan also showed video of what he said was his supporters being attacked by police. Khan's rallies and court appearances have been marred by violence. There have been confrontations between his supporters and police, but it's members of his party who say they are the victims. Camped outside his house in the city of Lahore, members of the Movement for Justice are convinced their presence is needed to protect their leader. The gates resemble a military barricade, but instead of soldiers, it's guarded by Khan's supporters.
We will eliminate the military that are involved in politics. If they think that Imran Khan will be no more and will be eliminated, we will vote for the party and this movement will continue. It can't be wiped out. It's in the people's hearts. Either Pakistan will progress or it will be torn apart.
And of course, in the background to all of this, Martin, is the fact that Pakistan is a nuclear power.
Well, indeed.
Not just nuclear power, nuclear weapons power.
Yes, indeed. And of course, we had Farouk in some weeks ago talking about this. I've forgotten his second name now.
Sadiq.
Farouk Sadiq, who's the head of the Bristol Pakistan Association. Imran Khan is clearly a major statesman. And if he will be eliminated, he's quite old, and one way or another, they've tried to assassinate him, or they've shot in the leg, wasn't he? And they could probably have shot him. That was an attempt to intimidate him. But I think he's definitely decided that he's going to go down fighting. And I think what's going to happen is that we could have a revolution in Pakistan, which will lead to a situation where it's no longer aligned with the United States, as it has been for many decades. And that will be another defeat for the unipolar world.
I'd say it's a little bit more light at the end of the tunnel there, Martin. Pakistan was showing distinct signs of not being with the United States, and that's what triggered this.
Oh, that's right. Imran Khan was pursuing an independent policy.
Yeah, yeah, with a lot of support.
Well, that's right. And, of course, I mean,
the coup may not stick.
Well, the problem is, it's a bit like Chavez in Venezuela. If it's dependent upon the charisma of one politician, then it's possibly that you can derail it by killing or I mean, he may just die of a heart attack.
So these crooked, treacherous Pakistani politicians, are they in secret societies or are they just bribed or what?
Well, the mainstream politicians in Pakistan of the main what used to be the major parties, they basically played Tweedledum and Tweedledee in power, and then when anything got out of control, the army would take over because the army is ultimately. They used to say that in Pakistan there are three A's that control Pakistan: army, Allah, and America, and that's still true.
Looking at Syria, US launches airstrikes in Syria after a drone attack kills a US contractor. Five US troops were wounded in the drone attack. Pentagon announced on Thursday night that it's launched airstrikes in Syria after a drone attack killed a US contractor and wounded five US troops near Hazakar in northeast Syria. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin said that the direction of President Biden, he authorized US Central Command forces to conduct precision airstrikes tonight in eastern Syria against facilities used by groups affiliated with Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Groups in the US targeted were likely Shia militias that operate in Syria. Now, I mean, this is a remote control war taking place from the other side of the world.
Yeah, well, I mean, the US presence in Syria is illegal.
Is it a little bit like the flying illegal of drones around Crimea? What are we doing?
What may happen is that the Syrian Arab army, you see, what another thing that's happened recently is that the Russians have got together with Assad and with Erdogan and tried to sort out what's going on in Syria. And ultimately, they're going to drive the Americans out. I mean, they've captured the oil, they control the Syrian oil fields using the YPG militias as their proxies. And of course, people from Bristol, Anna, I can't remember her second name, went to fight for the YPG and was killed by the Turks. You see, if we're going to send depleted uranium shells to the Ukraine, it may well be that the Russians won't retaliate in the Ukraine. They'll retaliate by bombing the US out of Syria, because they've only got a tiny foothold there. And of course, if the Israelis really want to have a war with the Russians and the Syrians, they could have one. And maybe the Russians will overwhelm the Israeli defences. I'm not saying it's going to happen, because the Russians are nothing if not cautious. And they've tried to mediate. That's what they do always. They're trying to mediate things. They're trying to settle things down. Before the Russians intervened in Syria, they contacted all of the armed groups fighting against the Syrian government and said, if you put down your arms, we will guarantee you a seat at the negotiating table. And many of them took that offer. And that's the way they operate. They prepare the ground very carefully before they send their people in. And then when they get there, they make sure they do the job properly. Unlike the British Army, who run out of Basra and run out of Helmand province and are totally unprofessional by comparison.
Over in Israel, far-right Israeli ministers threatened to reoccupy and recolonise Gaza. In 2005, former Prime Minister Ariel Sharon evacuated several Israeli settlements in Gaza, along with four settlements in northern occupied West Bank as part of his unilateral plan for disengagement. But a far-right Israeli minister threatened on Wednesday this week to reoccupy the besieged coastal enclave and recolonise settlements that were evacuated in the territory before 2005. Speaking to the Israeli Channel 7, Israeli Minister of National Missions, Orit Strock, said, "We have to return our settlements once again. I believe we have provided many sacrifices to restore Gaza."
Well, the right-wing Israeli government are the real joker in the pack, aren't they? Because they could just start a war for their own mad reasons, which isn't even actually in the interest of the American deep state. But the American deep state, they can't control them. And of course, if they do, then the roof will fall in. But of course, the Chinese getting the Iranians and the Saudis together means that the Abraham Accords, where the Saudis basically got together with the Israelis, have been undermined by the Chinese. If the Iranians and the Saudis agree not to fight each other, then the Israelis are becoming completely isolated. And their American friends won't be able to save them. I feel like saying to the Israeli right wing, the Pied Noir in Algeria, they were there for 120 years. They'd got used to living in Algeria. Algeria was their home. Algerie Francais. They all had to go. Now, all of the Jewish population, apart from the indigenous Jewish population, who were very hostile to the Zionists, they've all come since 1945. And maybe if you lose World War III, you are going to lose your state. You'll all have to go somewhere else, just as the French Pied Noir settlers had to go somewhere else. They all ended up in Marseille.
The Israeli army has attacked a Ramallah hospital during a raid, says a Palestinian health official. Patients in a Ramallah hospital were exposed to tear gas during an Israeli army raid at a refugee camp near the medical compound on Tuesday this week. The Wafa news agency reported that an Israeli army convoy stormed the Quadura refugee camp, conducted a house search of a former Palestinian prisoner. But all this tear gas goes at them. In fact, they say that the tear gas canisters were fired directly at the medical compound. As a result, patients in several wards, including cardiology, were exposed to tear gas and had to be evacuated.
Well, it's quite possible there's going to be an intifada in Palestine, and of course, a potential for a civil war in Lebanon. And the problem with wars is once they get going, it's like the First World War. It led to massive devastation across Africa, for example. Yeah, but people in Africa had nothing to do with the cause of the war in Europe. You know, they didn't, that like most people, they had no idea who Archduke Ferdinand was and why he was important. But it ended up devastating the whole of Africa.
Wars are easy to start and very difficult to
end, aren't they? That's right.
And I mean, it's an extraordinary time here, isn't it? Because we're living through a phase of hysteria and war fever here in Britain. And the more everything gets wobbly and uncertain and it looks like we might not be winning, the more the hysteria increases. I mean, yeah. I saw the Guardian newspaper. Can you believe this? The Guardian newspaper was attacking this Prime Minister for not being tough enough on China. I mean, what a weird world we're living in.
Well, did you see, on a positive note, what Paul Keating, the former Prime Minister of Australia, said about this AUKUS deal on nuclear submarines. He said it's the worst deal in history. We're just tying ourselves to the American desire to destroy China. And of course, the reason they hate China is because China's success. They've brought millions and millions of people out of poverty in the last 20 years in China. It's a huge success story, and they hate it.
This is the big secret. The big, really, really big secret is actually, we could all be very prosperous if only we ran our countries properly.
Well, that's exactly what the Chinese Communist Party has been saying. Yeah. There's no reason why we can't cooperate.
There's no need for
any fight about anything, is there? And of course, they are trying to be peacemakers in every single conflict. And of course, just as wars are difficult to stop, once you've got a logic behind peacemaking, that can get a momentum as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the Chinese, with all of the money they've got and the resources they've got to invest in countries, they could go into Africa where there's various conflicts and say, look, stop fighting here in Eritrea and Ethiopia. We're going to build railways for you and hospitals and schools.
That's actually what the UN was originally there for until Dag Hammarskjöld was assassinated by the Belgian, the British, and the far right in Saimar organization. Yeah. So he was a proactive guy. He would say, right, let's go out and sort this conflict out. But once he had been assassinated, it's a bit like the JFK assassination. A very clear message goes out. You start actually doing your job, you're going to get your head blown off. But anyway, Netanyahu, one of the things we've been talking about Israel here, but we haven't been talking about the massive demonstrations going on, which have been reported hardly anywhere except on Al Jazeera.
Well, a lot of people here are calling it Netanyahu's law. Basically, the law disallows the Attorney General from declaring the Prime Minister unfit for office. Why does this apply to Benjamin Netanyahu? Well, he has at least three court cases going through. They're winding through the system at the moment. So regardless of whatever the result of those court cases, he will continue to serve in office. And that, say the protesters, is undemocratic. It was one of the key things that the coalition government wanted to push forward. That's why this has been passed before other parts of the judicial reform bill. It's a series of reforms that's going to limit the Supreme Court's power. Now, because this bill is passed, we're likely to see more people out on the street on Saturday. There is also a protest across Israel, 95 different locations across Israel that's going on today. But the big protests, they're on Saturday, and it's likely to get more and more people out on the street. But the government is passing these laws. It's holding firm, and it's holding firm because it does have a very slim majority in Parliament, and that majority, that coalition, is holding firm because this is what the coalition wants. It wants to restrict the Supreme Court, and it seems to be working. So some form of this judicial reform bill will likely pass. Will it pass before Passover, before Easter, mid-April? We don't know. That's a key moment in time. So let's see what happens in the coming days. But absolutely, this is going to galvanize the protest movement. It'll get more and more people out on the streets.
And staying in the region, but looking at a different story, Imran, it is the first day of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, and Israel has imposed restrictions, or set rules rather, on worshippers entering the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem.
That's absolutely right. It's something that Israel does every single Ramadan. It takes, announces who can go and pray within the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the Old City. What they're saying is, if you're over the age of 55, yes, that's fine, you can go. Between 55 and 45, if you're male, you need to apply for a permit. And if you're under 45, you're simply not allowed to go. People won't be visiting from, say, the occupied West Bank, which they have been allowed to do in previous years. These restrictions are placed all the time, and they get tougher and tougher as kind of Ramadan goes on. It's just a fact of living under occupation. Now, the Israeli police say that they have learnt from clashes that took place when they placed restrictions in 2020. Those clashes were almost every single night in Damascus Gate, in occupied East Jerusalem, and they eventually led to the war on Gaza, that 11-day war that took place in May. So the police say, yes, we have learned. We are going to allow people to go to the mosque. We're not going to use heavy-handed security tactics. That is something that the police, the guy in charge of the police, effectively, this national security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, doesn't want. He wants a hard line. So there's this disconnect now between what the police are saying publicly and what the national security minister wants. And that is being seen as a flashpoint.
So there's the report that you won't get here in the UK about what's actually going on in Israel. Sounds like tomorrow is going to be even more mass demonstrations and very little reporting about this bill that's going through the Israeli parliament, which is going to give Netanyahu complete immunity to prosecution whilst he's got three criminal court cases against him chugging through the courts.
Well, the right wing in Israel want to get rid of the Supreme Court in Israel completely. They just don't want
Just have a dictatorship.
Yeah, I mean, it's like 1933 in Germany. They're trying to get rid of the checks and balances but within which the so-called democracy in Israel has functioned. And, of course, the Palestinians watch these demonstrations against Netanyahu by Netanyahu's political opponents within the Israeli political system. There's nothing in there for them from either side. They're losing any kind of hope of any kind of negotiation solution to where their problems lie. The Palestinian Authority in the West Bank has stopped all cooperation, security cooperation, with the Israelis because the Palestinian population has absolutely had enough. And you can see that this is a pressure cooker boiling. And, of course, in Lebanon, they're trying to form a government at the moment. There is a possibility that it might happen because of the rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia. The Saudis are now talking indirectly to Hezbollah and to... And I understand from reading this afternoon, the problem is that the Christians who are in line, there's two major Christian factions. One of them was aligned with Hezbollah, and they've fallen out. But they have to find a president and a prime minister because the Lebanese constitution, which was tweaked at the end of the civil war, gives each community, and each religious community some guarantees of a seat at the top table.
Okay, so where is Benjamin Netanyahu today?
Definitely not as he did on when he came on 7/7. He was supposed to be visiting the London School of Economics, wasn't he? But he didn't go because the Israelis had a warning that there was going to be a bomb attack.
You're getting warm. He's in Downing Street.
So he is in this country.
Israel turmoil dogs Netanyahu's UK trip. This is the BBC a couple of hours ago. Some signs being waved with Israeli flags outside Downing Street. Crime minister. It's not about left versus right. It's about human rights. Benjamin Netanyahu walked the length of Downing Street towards a warm welcome from Rishi Sunak from Goldman Sachs. The sounds of anguished protests will have been ringing in his ears. It's nothing that hasn't been seen and heard on a vastly bigger scale on the streets of his own country in recent weeks. So what do you think he might be doing here? I mean, hasn't he got his own country to try and sort out?
Well, he's part of the axis of evil, isn't it? Which is the Israelis, the British, and the Americans. We are the axis of evil, and he's part of it.
In a joint document signed by the British and Israeli foreign ministers on Tuesday this week, the two sides said their bilateral relationship has never been stronger as freedom-loving, innovative, and thriving democracies. The document known as the 2030 Roadmap went on, Israel and the UK are proud of our deep and historic partnership. We are firm friends and natural allies.
Well, that's what Keir Starmer thinks as well. But, of course, the Israelis could start a war in the Middle East, which will put Keir Starmer on the spot, because the Labour Party activists and Labour voters do not want a war in the Middle East. What may happen as a result of the rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran is that the Israelis cannot attack Iran now, because they would have required Saudi cooperation to do it. And also the possibility of this deal is that there's a ceasefire in Yemen and the Saudis may withdraw from Yemen, which they should have done years ago as a result of Chinese mediation.
Well, I'm a little bit nervous whenever I see Netanyahu over here. What the hell are they cooking up?
Well, as I say, on the day of 7/7, he was supposed to be going to a meeting and, the Times of Israel phoned the embassy. We've heard there's been a bomb attack in Britain. Is BB safe? And the embassy said, yes, he's safe because we got a warning about a bomb attack and he didn't leave the embassy, so he had a warning. That implies to my mind that whoever was behind the 7/7 attacks, the Israelis had foreknowledge, they are therefore suspects. Of course they are. What else?
Okay, so our final item is really looking at the geopolitics section of the show is from John Stockwell. Do you want to say something about him, Martin? Do you know much about him? He wrote a book, I think it was one of the most fantastically titled books, which I read years ago. It's called In Search of Enemies, which is all about US foreign policy. He'd been
ex-CIA, isn't he?
He was in Vietnam, he was in Angola, etc.
He's the highest, most senior ever person from within the deep state to blow the whistle, and he was actually on the national security. He wasn't only in the CIA, he was later on the national security staff at the White House.
Anyway, fascinating talk, and I'll put the full version of it up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I think it's from the 80s or the early 90s, but here's John Stockwell talking about how things really work from his point of view in the USA.
This establishment, this party that we have, the single party state, this fraternity that runs this country, that has two chapters, a Republican and a Democrat, one a little bit more liberal than the other one, one more conservative representing the big business interests more directly. That's the Republicans. In terms of their interests, that's the A team. But they always have the B team that they can run out, a Jimmy Carter when Richard Nixon makes the nation too angry, or the nation gets too riled at the Vietnam War, or something like that. This is where they produced Michael Dukakis. He's a team player to the establishment. In order to be accepted as a presidential candidate, he did homage to the arms race. He said eventually that he would give humanitarian aid to the Contras. He would consider it. He said definitely he would give military aid to El Salvador, which means he bought into all the principles of the covert secret government, of the covert operations, of the covert manipulation of the world.
He was singing another song when he was trying to get the Democratic nomination.
That's right. Before, his background was progressive, but he bought in. They screened him into the system. They groomed him into the system. He was advised that he could run, but if he would... So what he was there is, he, if the nation had clung, had its outrage had been sufficient over the Iran-Contra scandal, they had Dukakis standing by, the B team to their interests, and he would give them some grief by spending some money on housing and on medical insurance for people and things like that, which is not their choice of the way to invest the money. They want to invest it in missiles and things where they make greater profits. But he would support the arms race, and he would support the CIA and the covert establishment, the National Security State's activities. But then they realized they did not have to go with the B team. The people didn't care. They didn't have to give the nation a B team. So they went ahead and went with the A team, which was George Bush. I.e., they concluded eventually that they could Teflonize Bush despite all of this incredible activity and sell him to the nation, and they did.
Mm. Why, though, did Dukakis as the B team not go after Bush more aggressively?
Because he's a member of the team. He's a member of the fraternity.
Mm-hmm. So that's former CIA Colonel John Stockwell, author of In Search of Enemies, a fascinating study of 1980s and 90s US foreign policy. What do you make of him, Ian? Because this is all in the run-up to the 9/11 attacks, and the idea really is that the US is on track to control the world using the CIA. I quite like his terminology of the A team and the B team. Really, it's a one-party state.
It is a one-party state. It's about sociology. You know, I think it's a pity more people don't study sociology and social psychology, because you can sort of predict it. You know, it's a class. It's a class system. You know, Marx might not have got it exactly right as to which classes are which, and they can vary over time. But essentially, you've got this phrase, to be honest, you know, to be fair, they are quite honest if you read between the lines. They talk about inside the beltway. Well, that's sort of code for this governing class, you know. That's a bit like being a Communist Party member in the Soviet Union. You know, you're inside the beltway. You might not carry a card, but people will soon notice if you haven't got a card. And, you know, and that's just how it works. And the public, they get pressured. It's not a rational I'm sorry to say, and I wish it was, but the way things run at the moment, it's not really a rational process. I mean, this war fever, that hasn't been, there's not a, there's not, it's not rational. It's about, it's about hysteria. You know, it's the media are very, very skilled at spreading hysteria, and they do it by lulling you into a comfort zone, and then suddenly they kick you in the guts. Oh, Putin's just invaded Ukraine. My God, panic, panic, you know, and that's how it works. And people don't like to stand up. I remember.
Don't you think a lot of people have got switched off and turned off about this, though? That
they do.
People are looking at the television saying, well, this is the sort of panic of the week, and we may as well just disregard it.
Well, yes, but you've got the
overuse of fear, I suppose. They're trying to use fear all the time.
I mean, their worry is, of course, that's what they're saying this, you know, if you read between the lines again. The worry is that people get bored, you know, because the media do depend on immediacy and sensation and news, you know. And if it's, Putin's taking another city in East, they're worried that, you know, if they don't do it fast enough, then, you know, the public will get bored and some opposition politician will start taking advantage and the whole thing might just peter out. But of course that won't harm the elite that much, because they'll have got most of what they wanted anyway, even if it petered out tomorrow. But it would be sure great for the people of Ukraine, East and West, you know, if it would peter out sooner rather than later.
Anyway, sorry we haven't had time to play the piece. We'll do it next week from John Wareham and Roger Green at the Coles Hill Auxiliary Research Trust, Britain's Gladio. You can still go and have a look at them if you want before next week. Next week's show, they're up at the website staybehinds.com. I basically just stumbled into this lot and went along to their get-together in Coles Hill in Oxfordshire last week, and they will explain all. There's quite a lot of activities coming up in the summer that CART are organising and have been organising. But that's for next week. Thanks very much to Ian Henshaw. And maybe you can just finally maybe mention your books, Ian, and where people can get hold of them the 9/11 stuff. I mean, it is, the thing I like about it is it's compact. It's got pretty much everything in there. It's got pictures, and it's a tiny little book, but it's a great little thing to pull out as a reference book. We all need something to jog our memories about what really happened on 9/11.
Yeah. Well, it's called 9/11, The New Evidence, and it's still available, actually. I don't want to sound too conceited, but it is unusual for a book to be still available 15 years after it was published. And what that's saying is that it's time somebody else updated 9/11, really, because that's my book is actually the most up-to-date, cynical, you know, critical version.
Do you want to just give us one little tidbit from it for which people may not have heard about, is basic bits of information?
Well, I think Hani Hanjour is the guy you want to know about. I mean, he's the guy who's supposed to have flown the plane into the Pentagon by sort of an extraordinary, you know, aerial manoeuvres, and yet flight trainers are on record as telling the American mainstream media, you know, you haven't got to go onto the internet for this, but mainstream media, Hani Hanjour is such a crap pilot that we didn't even trust him to fly a small plane. And he's the guy who's supposed to have hit the Pentagon. And that's in a sense all you need to know about
9/11. Yeah, he did some sort of upside down maneuver, pulling about 25G, didn't he, in an airliner, apparently.
Yeah, well, he flew at 500 miles an hour about sort of 20 foot, excuse me if I'm a bit rusty on this, about 25 foot above the ground, you know, which even the top, you know, Air Force pilot couldn't have done.
A lot of people have speculated that was actually probably a cruise missile rather than an airliner.
There's loads of speculation, you know. It's much harder to say what happened than it is to say what didn't happen. But what didn't happen is that America was successfully taken by surprise by a bunch of Islamic terrorists who carried out the 9/11 attacks. That didn't happen.
What's the relevance for 9/11, Martin, do you think, today?
Well, it's just a part of, of course, the Gladio stuff we've been talking about earlier in the 1970s in Italy. And what happened at the Maidan Square in 2014 when the demonstrators were shot down by snipers. NATO is a terrorist organisation. We need Interpol to arrest people like Colonel Boyenga, the US officer in charge of the sniper attack in 2014 in Maidan Square. We know about this because there's a court case in Kiev which named him. Probably not his real name, but that ought to be enough for somebody like a director of public prosecutions like Keir Starmer to look into it. Well, before he goes to war with Russia.
There's been a lot of talk about Nazis, you know, people like Gary Lineker throwing this thing around. Suella Braverman's a Nazi, apparently. And I'm concerned that actually the real Nazis might be the Americans. They seem to think that, like Adolf Hitler, they can just march into any country they want to ever since the 9/11 attacks.
Well, that's true. And, of course, the real Nazis were embedded within the NATO intelligence structure, like Reinhard Gehlen, who was the head of the Gestapo, who becomes the head
quite
of
a lot
the
BND, of Nazis,
the West German intelligence
services.
I mean, quite
services, a lot of Nazis were welcomed.
Working for the Americans and the British,
in the US with open arms, given nice pensions and things like that, because they wanted to use them to fight the Soviet Union.
Well, that's right. And, you know, this stuff is not new. It's been going on for years, but it's coming to a head. What is new is that they've now got peer competition on the economic front from the Chinese and on the military front from the Russians.
Yes, and they're going down. I mean, yeah. At the end of the day, of course.
Well, I mean, they've got to. I mean, all of the war dead in two world wars in this country will have died for nothing unless these people are comprehensively defeated.
Absolutely right. Thanks very much, Martin. And we're going to wind up with a... the United Nations is an interesting institution. Very difficult to have an opinion one way or the other on it, really, because things like the General Assembly are absolutely fantastic. I don't know if anyone's ever seen Colonel Gaddafi's great speech to the UN General Assembly, where he talks about things like the use of pandemics in order to poison people, and, you know, by the West, basically. Then there's the very flawed Security Council. It always strikes me as very peculiar that the military wing of the UN is more powerful and above in the pyramid the General Assembly. But there's also the fact that this deal was done in 2019 between the World Economic Forum and the United Nations, which is effectively a kind of hostile takeover bid. But our final item tonight is looking at the multi-faith agenda, a kind of one world religion, which is being reflected through the United Nations too. I didn't know they were into religion, but apparently they are.
In 1982, full-page advertisements around the world announced the coming of Krem's New Age Christ, which gave fresh hope to millions. At this press conference in Los Angeles, he described how this Christ would make himself known.
It is a truism today to say that we are at the dawn of a new age, the age of Aquarius. And it is important to remember that all of the great religions await the coming of a teacher. The Christians await the return of the Christ. The Muslims await the Imam Mahdi. At the same time, the Buddhists await the coming of another Buddha. The Hindus await the return of Krishna, and the Jews, as always, await the coming of the Messiah. I am speaking today about the return of such a teacher.
Christians are awaiting the return of the resurrected Jesus with the nail prints in his hands and feet. But the followers of the gurus are awaiting a coming world ruler who won't even claim to be Jesus, but the latest reincarnation of the Christ spirit. And he will have the psychic powers to prove it.
Simultaneously, throughout the world will take place hundreds of thousands of spontaneous healings and cures, which will reinforce, if that were even necessary, the fact that it is the Christ himself. The day of declaration will be the outstanding event of this or any other century. On that day, the radio and the television networks of the world will be linked together. We shall see this extraordinary face on our television screens. But he will not speak. His words will drop silently into our minds in our own language.
This is the significance of the altered state of consciousness reached in yoga and other forms of Eastern meditation. A Nobel Prize winner has described the brain as, quote, a machine that a ghost can operate, unquote. What that means is, in an altered state of consciousness, the connection between my spirit that normally operates my brain and my brain is loosened, and that allows another spirit being to interpose itself, begin to tick off the neurons in the brain, create an entire universe of illusion, astral travel, give psychic powers. In this way, the world is being prepared for some ultimate delusion.
He will indeed inaugurate a great new world religion, and at the very most sacred core of that new world religion will be the process which
is called the esoteric initiations, which take us out of the strictly human kingdom into the kingdom of God.
David Spangler, board member of the Planetary Initiative for the World We Choose, which comes out of the United Nations, declares that Lucifer is the same force as Christ, that Lucifer prepares us for our own Christhood, that this is the final Luciferic initiation into the New Age.
Benjamin Krems Christ may not be the world teacher and ruler of world peace as he forecasted, but without question the stage is being set today for what the Bible calls the apostasy, or man's abandonment of God. This climate is ushering in the final actor, the counterfeit, who the Bible predicts must come before the return of Jesus, the true Prince of Peace, who will then reign for 1,000 years.
The merger of science and mysticism is now in full blossom, and its evil fruit will be the new universal religion of the coming world dictator that the Bible identifies as the Antichrist.
So, fascinating. Did you know that about the United Nations, that they're kind of involved in all this? The Baha'is having a seat, whereabouts was it? The Baha'is have a seat? We're not sure where, but somewhere. Anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to Ian Henshaw and to Jasmine York. Also, of course, sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do send me interviews, story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show at page and poems. Sorry, Patricia, I forgot to read your poem out. Maybe if I've got it in front of me here, I know. No, I had a few problems with the computer this week, so I didn't bring it along with me, unfortunately. You can subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling, and I'm going to say something a little bit about Twitter, because they have now made it so that they can you can only confirm that you are who you say you are by email. The only thing is, the email takes an hour or more to actually arrive. And when the email does arrive, it's backdated to an hour before that. So they're trying to pretend, or I don't know how on earth that happens, but so it makes it very difficult to actually log in to Twitter to prove who you are, who you say you are. After lots and lots of messing about with it over several evenings, probably a half an hour spent trying to figure out what on earth's going on, I finally managed to download my Twitter archive. So they've made that extremely difficult to do now, whether that's on purpose or whether someone's gotten into Elon Musk's machine and is trying to do that, God only knows. But anyway, have a go at download. It's always a good idea to, if you've got any stuff up on Facebook, on particularly on YouTube or Twitter, download your archive so you've got a copy of it. So, because of course, when they decide they're going to cancel you, all that data goes down the toilet. So make sure you've got a copy of it yourself. Also, for those subscribers who've been having trouble getting our emails who are on Gmail, somebody is texting me this week saying, try and, if you go in there and approve my email address and you say, yes, this is a genuine email address, and you don't want it to go into trash, that sort of thing, on Gmail. I've not used Gmail. I don't know how you use it, but apparently you can say that and hopefully the emails might start arriving again. But the best thing is to have nothing whatsoever to do with Google, isn't it? That's the obvious solution. Get off of Gmail. There's all sorts of other things. Proton Mail, goodness knows what else. I'm not sure. I'm not in any position to say use a specific different one. But Gmail is an absolute nightmare. And Google itself is basically just a front end for the Nazis. Let's just say that what it is, the National Security Agency. My paperbacks, firstly about deals between the Allies and the Nazis at the end of the Second World War, the Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderbergers, that cost £15. Also my secret government anthology from Cromwell to the Princess Diana assassination, The Siege of Heaven Reader. They're both up on eBay, and you'll find the Siege of Heaven ebook with all my articles, including this year's ones too, via www.bilderberg.org. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, and over Sunday, breakfast at CamberleysRadioQUK.com. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. live on the glorious Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast the show, please let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream on the app and at talkradio.org.uk at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the auto ab KO banksters get you down.
Thank you.